Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
It's my kind of town. My kind of town, Chicago is. My kind of town, Chicago is. My kind of razzmatazz.
Day player on 720 WGN. So this December marks the 100th anniversary of the birth of the chairman of the board, Mr. Frank Sinatra. Now, as a recording artist, actor, cabaret and concert star, radio, film and television personality, an occasional producer, director and conductor, Frank Sinatra's achievements earned him 3 Oscars, 2 Golden Globes, 10 personal Grammys, and a total of 21, including those for his albums, an Emmy, a Cecil B. DeMille Award, and a Peabody. He won one of the most prestigious awards, and that was the Gene Herschold Humanitarian Award by the Motion Picture Society of America. He performed on more than 1,400 recordings, was awarded 31 gold, 9 platinum, 3 double platinum, and 1 triple platinum album by the Recording Industry Association of America. He's appeared in 58 films, produced 8 motion pictures. He was awarded Lifetime Achievement Awards from the Grammys, the Screen Actors Guild, the Kennedy Center, and the NAACP, as well as the Presidential Medal of Freedom and the Congressional Gold Medal, and remains a legend and inspiration to thousands for his contributions to culture and the arts. He's one of the best-selling music artists of all time, having sold more than 150 million records worldwide. Sinatra has 3 stars on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, and tonight we're going to celebrate 100 years of Frank. Now, he was married to Nancy Sinatra, Ava Gardner, Mia Farrow, and his 4th wife, Barbara. There's his kids, Nancy Jr., Frank Jr., and Christina. There was the Rat Pack, which was led by Frank along with Dean Martin, Sammy Davis, Peter Lawford, and Joey Bishop. And Frank always surrounded himself with friends that were loyal to him, protected him, and loved him. Jilly Rizzo was one of his closest friends and his chief aides. Elliot Wiseman was his manager. And my guest tonight became his co-manager, his road manager, and one of Sinatra's closest friends. And that is Mr. Tony Opitasano, Tony O. Tony, welcome to the show, my friend. We've been talking about getting together for months and doing this, so I'm so glad it finally came together.
I appreciate the introduction, and if you were waiting to do this for months, you got to get out of the house more.
I probably do. No, I'm really excited. I mean, you've got such a close connection to such an amazing time, not only in the music industry, in Hollywood, but really old school entertainment and show business. And that's what makes you such a special guy. You know, I want to talk about your beginnings. And I know, like Frank, you grew up in New York in 1950s Brooklyn.
Yes. Yes, I did. And in a predominantly Italian neighborhood. Back then, they had neighborhoods. I think they still have neighborhoods, but not to the extent that they did when I was a kid. But it was a, I wouldn't trade it for all the money in the world, because it's the same growing up in New York and catching the tail end of the nightclub era. It's an education that you can't buy.
Well, you have been in the entertainment world really since a very young age. At age 5, you taught yourself how to play the piano.
Yeah. Yeah, we had an upright, and it was a like a player piano with those rolls, and but I used to go down to the basement and play. I somehow just had a gift where I could hear something and sit down and play it. I was always good at math, so you know, music and math are very, very heavily related to each other. Mm-hmm. Maybe that had something to do with it, but it was a constant companion, I mean, aside from my friends, when I was happy, I'd go down and play the piano. If I was sad, I went down and played the piano. And it was something that just came natural to me, unfortunately.
Well, music did in general. I mean, you went on to play six more instruments, like the guitar, the mandolin, the violin, the viola, the cello, the bass. I mean, you're a pretty musical guy. And I know, you know, you were, you know, later years, you were underage, but you began playing in nightclubs around New York City. And you were playing in some pretty big clubs back then.
Yeah, I was very fortunate. And I got lucky, and I always tried to push myself to try to work with guys that were better than I was, because I always knew that I wouldn't embarrass myself, but I was always trying to grow to that next level. And the best way to do that is to play with guys that are more experienced than you are and better than you are, and you'd be surprised what it pulls out of you.
Now, at 19, you were playing jazz at Jilly's on 52nd Street. Tell me a little bit about who, and for the folks that might not know the background, who Jilly Rizzo was.
The way I like to say it is that Jilly, for all intents and purposes, was the brother that Frank never had. He truly was that close with him. And Jilly was a very enterprising guy, not very book learned. As I wrote in the foreword that I wrote for the book that his son Willie put out a couple of years back. But when it came to street smarts, the guy could give a postgraduate dissertation on street smarts. And he was a very giving guy, imposing figure, but mostly bark, very little bite. And he and Frank Lick had a point in Frank's life when it wasn't extremely beneficial to be a friend of Frank Sinatra. It was during his down period in the early 50s when he was trying to climb his way back. And Jilly befriended him and would spend his own money to travel around and show up at places where Frank was working. So in Frank's mind, it was kind of, this guy wants to be my friend for me, not who I supposedly am in the public and what I might be able to do for him.
You know, it's funny you say that. I mean, those are times and those moments in life. And nobody really, you know, nobody really remembers those down times in Frank's career, because, I mean, he was so successful right until the end. And, you know, everyone hits their lows and their highs, but you really know who mm-hmm. your friends are during those times.
Frank used to say that friends sometimes that are like shadows. You only see them when the sun is shining. He said it's a human weakness.
But Jilly was also a mentor to you.
Yeah, absolutely. Jilly introduced me to, well, he introduced me to Frank, and he and I, you know, did a lot of business together. When I finally gave up my performing career, we did a lot of projects together, managing people, and I was producing television stuff, and he would help me line up talent. Jilly was the kind of guy that he would help people that he saw were talented. And the phrase he used to use, I like to help people get where they deserve to be. And for him, the reward was watching them become a success.
That's a true friend. True friend.
Yeah.
You mentioned producing some television and doing some of this with him. I was looking at some of the things in the 80s here. You know, we're producing specials that starred the likes of Jerry Seinfeld and Bob Saget, a lot of stand-up comedy stuff, Alan King, some great sports stuff as well that included Sammy Davis and Frank Sinatra. You know, that's what a great, you gave up your career. I mean, you still played clubs and stuff, you know, through the 70s, but you kind of gave it up because you saw kind of a new avenue for yourself.
Yeah, I started getting into the singing. So I always sang choir in Brooklyn and, you know, in Catholic school and all of that stuff. But I only started singing in clubs by necessity. I remember one gig on Long Island. The promoter that booked us into this place, he booked the wrong band for the wrong function. And we were playing jazz, and these people were just getting so bored. And so when we took a break, I went over to the piano player And I said, listen, do you know time after time? Do you know this tune? Do you know that tune in these keys? Blah, blah, blah. If you don't, I can write them out. He said, why? I said, because I'm not going to play guitar when we go back. I'm going to try something. And we went back on the bandstand, and I started to sing. And all of a sudden, people reacted. They got up. They went out on the dance floor. And that's when I decided to start singing. And little by little was getting away from playing instruments. And the last 8 years or so of my career, that's all I did was sing. But unfortunately, in the early 80s, the music industry was turning its back on that kind of sophisticated music and was going into disco and then grunge and then heavy metal. And even though I had recorded six sides with Nelson Riddle in the hope of landing a contract, unless you were already an established performer, there was no shot of that. Even those guys were struggling at that period of time.
But, Tony, you had a talent, though, for executive producing and managing people in their careers. I mean, you found that out pretty quickly. And, you were a big part of Frank Sinatra's life. You two became fast friends probably for a decade before you even started getting involved in his management or more. And, you know, I know it was 26 years that you guys were friends and you knew him. But you eventually became his co-manager and his road manager. I mean, you traveled with him all the time. Tell me how that all kind of came about.
Well, the introduction came about because of Jilly. Mm-hmm. I was playing with Jilly's, thanks to Jilly's older brother, Frank, who ran the club when Jilly was traipsing around the world with Frank. And I used to go into the club. It's really ironic. There was probably the single best live album that was ever done is Sinatra at the Sands. And 1965, I was just going into high school and already a dyed-in-the-wool fan of Sinatra and Basie. And I kept hearing Frank talk about Jilly's and Jilly's and Jilly's. So when I finally started hanging out in the city, working clubs, I said, you know, I got to check this place out. And I used to go in there, and I was always with a tuxedo. And finally, Uncle Frank said to me one day, you know, you're always in a tux. What do you do? I said, well, I'm a jazz musician. Oh. So, well, if you get done early tonight, why don't you come back to the joint? I'd love to hear you play. I did. He loved it. He says, I got to talk to my brother about putting you in the regular rotation, which is what ended up happening. Wow. About a year into this, I guess when Jilly sussed me out and figured out that he could trust me, that I wasn't angling to make some kind of moves, he felt comfortable enough to engineer putting me in with Frank. And I met him on December 8, 1972 at the Rainbow Grill. It was Frank Jr. was performing there. It was his closing night. And after the show, we went back to Jilly's. And about 2 o'clock, Jilly said to me, so do you still have your guitar in the car? I said, oh, sure. Why? He said, because I think the old man wants to hang out tonight. I'm going to close the club right at 4 o'clock. He says, and I want him to hear you play. And I swear to God,
what an opportunity.
I'm thinking to myself, Maron, why did I put away so much Jack Daniels tonight?
Most people are a little more creative after a couple of belts, so, you know.
Well, I got the guitar, went back in the club, Joe Patrone on piano, Lou Berryman on bass, and we did what nightclub performers do: pick a tune, call a key, count the tempo, and you're off to the races. It worked, and about 6 tunes into this, Joe Patrone said to me, you know, Tone, why don't you do something by yourself, just guitar, a la Joe Pass or Bucky Pizzarelli. Mm-hmm. And okay. So I started to play a tune that I knew Frank had a soft spot for. He had just recorded it a couple of years earlier, a tune called How Insensitive. And the next thing I know, Frank, who was sitting across the piano from me, starts humming. And I swear to God, I almost dropped the guitar. And he goes from humming to singing. And now I go from playing the lead chords and melody together to accompanying him. And it just worked. It worked. He sang the tune through. I played it up to the bridge. He picked it up and sang it out. And it just, as though we had rehearsed, it just worked out magically. And that was the beginning of of a long friendship, thanks to Jilly. And then evidently, Frank seemed to enjoy my company because he used to tell Jilly whenever he was coming into the city, you know, see what the kid's doing, see
kid.
Come around. Yeah. Well, we were 36 years. I was 36 years his junior.
Yeah.
And I used to bring a lot of my young musician friends around as well. If he got a kick out of it.
He probably loved that. Absolutely.
Well, at this point in his life, Dave, he was in his self-imposed retirement, which he told me was a period, a fallow period, he used to call it, that he wanted to take a breather and figure out really what he wanted to do with the rest of his life. Thankfully, he had, you know, enough money that he really didn't have to do very much. He didn't want to. And he wanted to spend more time with family and friends. But he was also, he told me 20-some-odd years later, at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning after a lot of booze, that part of the reason was also that he was not truly convinced how relevant he was to my generation. And he didn't want to do things that would embarrass himself by falling flat. And he said part of what gave him the inspiration to come back was the fact that I was bringing around all these younger guys that were thrilled to be in this company and hanging on his every word and talking music with him, everything else. And that coupled with boatloads of letters, from what I'm told, is what convinced him that he really did mean something and still had a lot to give. And in June of 1973, he went in, recorded Old Blue Eyes Is Back, and that fall was back in full swing, bigger than ever.
We're commemorating Frank Sinatra's centennial with one of his managers and closest friends, Tony Opodisano, and there's more with him next on 720 WGN.
That's life.
That's life.
That's what all the people say. You're riding high in April, shot down in May. But I know I'm going to change that.
It's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN, and we're celebrating 100 years of Frank Sinatra in an exclusive interview with manager, producer, and close friend of Frank's, Tony Opodisano. You know, Tony, we left off talking about Frank questioning his own relevance, and it must have been the early 90s when I was lucky enough to see Frank in concert in New York. And for someone there in their early 20s, it was a thrill for me to see the legendary Frank Sinatra perform at any age.
I'm the one who was bestowed the most honors. I mean, I was there listening to this stuff every night, hanging with him before the show, after the show, till he went to bed. I was one of the first people he looked for whenever he woke up. And we spent thousands, tens of thousands of hours alone.
What was it like being on the road with Frank? I mean, that must have been just, you know, surreal. I mean, going Vegas to New York to everywhere.
It absolutely was. And, you know, growing up in New York, I had one view of New York, and then coming back to New York after having moved away in 1976, coming back and seeing New York out the windows of a helicopter or a Gulfstream jet or a limousine, I saw a completely different New York than I realized exist.
I bet.
But yeah, it was a very interesting. I could not have envisioned it myself in my wildest dreams that it would ever happen. All I knew going through high school. And high school chums reminded me of this many times, especially after Frank passed away, that I was determined to become a friend of his. And it's, I don't want to get heavy into psychology or anything else, but, you know, visualization, evidently, maybe it is something that works.
You've got to have one great, funny Frank Sinatra story that I'd like you to share, just your favorite that you love telling.
You know, there are so, you're like, yeah, there are so many. And it's, Frank used to use the phrase when people would say, what's your favorite song? He's just like asking a fat person what his favorite food is. But okay, I'll give you one just to give you an idea how sometimes Frank, who truly was not completely aware of the magnitude of his persona in the world. He truly didn't quite get it. But occasionally, he would use that persona and have fun with it. Okay, there was a story where we were at the Desert Inn in Vegas, and we had been up all night, the two of us. People would peel off one at a time, go to the bathroom, never come back, and it usually ended up with just the two of us and a security guard at another table. And it was now going on 7 o'clock or so in the morning, and I said to Frank, I looked at my watch, and I said, you know, even for you, it's a respectable hour to go to bed. I said, it's not going to hurt your reputation. I said, it's seven and change in the morning. Yeah, I guess you're right. He said, besides, we got another show tonight. And all that stuff. Okay, let's get out of here. Well, for the last hour or so that we were sitting there drinking, we were watching this lady in the casino playing slot machine feverishly. And she was just heavily engrossed, never looked up. Cocktail waitress walked by her and stopped and asked her if she wanted a drink. I don't know how many times. No coffee, no nothing. So as we're walking out, Frank looked at me and he motioned with his head to follow me. And we walked up behind this slot machine, and Frank leaned his arms and he put his hands on top, his head on top of his hands, his chin on top of his hands, staring at this woman. And she looked up and she almost fell off the chair when she saw who it was.
Yeah.
And he said to her, how you doing, sweetheart? She says, honest? He says, of course. She says, my husband's going to kill me. She says, I've lost close to $250. She says, I can't get a break. But Frank looks at me and he says, oh, well, that's no good. And he walks around the side of the machine. And at this point in his life, he was carrying nothing but $100 bills. And he takes out this wad and he peels off $500 and he puts it on the machine and he says, here you go, sweetheart. Now we're partners. He says, and by the way, you keep my half. And he gave her a kiss on the cheek and we walked away. So we go out the back and we're walking past the pool to go to the Wimbledon Tower, which is where his suite was. And he starts laughing. I said, what? What's so funny? He says, that poor woman. I says, yeah. He says, no, that's not what I mean. He says, that poor woman is going to spend the rest of the day trying to convince people that what just happened actually.
And that's probably what happened.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's fantastic.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on a Jupiter.
Welcome back. It's Dave Player on 720 WGN. We're commemorating the centennial of the chairman of the board, Frank Sinatra, with one of his managers and closest friends, Tony Opitasano. Well, you know, you mentioned in the you know, there was a time Frank wanted to figure out if he was relevant or not. In the early 90s, he performed 65 concerts in 1990, 73 in 91, 84 in 92, in 17 different countries, never stopped working.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you talk about relevance. I mean, that was another resurgence. And everybody wanted to see Frank. Everybody.
Well, he enjoyed it. He really, let's face it, even though Frank had a terrific personal life and he enjoyed his friends and he going out to restaurants and all that kind of stuff, where he truly lived, like most performers, was out there on the stage. That's where he really, really, really came to life, enjoyed himself. You know, he would walk 15 feet away from me, and I would see 20 years melt off him. He just enjoyed it. And he used to look at me when we would get the calendars from the, you know, Elliot, the promoter, the premier artist's office. And Frank would say to me, how come there's so many empty boxes? And they said, to fill up these boxes, I want to do more stuff. Put more stuff in me.
Wow.
He just enjoyed it. He thoroughly enjoyed it.
Now, you were there. I'm sorry, go ahead.
One of the things that he really got a kick out of, it's too long a story to tell you now, but the duets albums almost didn't happen on two different occasions for a couple of different reasons. But at any rate, what he got a real kick out of, because he always kept his thumb on what was going on in the industry, He read Billboard. He stayed on top of everything that was going on. He applauded every other entertainer that came along and made noise, like Madonna and everybody else. And one of the things that really thrilled him was that the week his album came out, at age 78, any minute, he knocked Pearl Jam out of number one place on Billboard.
That made him
that
happy.
Thrilled him. That thrilled him to death.
Well, it was his best-selling album. I mean, it was Luther Vandross, it was Aretha Franklin, it was Barbra Streisand, it was Julio Iglesias, Gloria Estefan, Tony Bennett, Natalie Cole, Carly Simon, Liza Minnelli, Bono from U2. I mean, that was that crossed every generation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The one regret that he had with that was that he, because she was not well, was he really wanted a duet with Ella Fitzgerald. But she had, you know, some real health issues, and she wasn't quite up to it. But, he got a kick out of it. He really enjoyed it. And at that point in his life, to have that kind of success, again, even he couldn't have envisioned it. He was thrilled.
I know that, you know, in 1998, you were with Frank right until the end. And at some point, Frank bestowed the honor on you to distribute some of his personal things. That meant a lot to him. It wasn't really about, you know, property and wills and that type of stuff. It was about things that meant something to him, and he entrusted you. I mean, you really became, you know, you were great friends with him to begin with, but then when Jilly passed away, I mean, you were the closest to him, and he knew that, you know, the end was coming, and he wanted you to take care of some things.
Yeah. We were down in the desert, and a lot of things like that, very heavy, quote-unquote, things would happen 2 or 3 in the morning. And we were sitting out by the pool, and he said, listen, I want to talk to you about something. Why don't you meet me in the theater? He had a freestanding theater on his property. And I went into the theater, and he went into the main house, and a few minutes later, he comes into the theater with a satchel and put it on the table. And he said, the contents of this satchel are things that I've been putting aside since the late 30s, early 40s, all the way up till just before I married Barbara in 1976. He said, the contents of the satchel belongs to my blood, my children, and my first wife. And I would like to have you take care of these things for me and make sure that they get this stuff after, the word he used. He said, you'll know when the time is right. I don't want this stuff to become part of a tug of war with all kinds of factions. He said, when things are quiet, I'd like for you to get hold on to this stuff and make sure my family gets it. The contents of the satchel ranged from a small locket that he used to hang on the mirror when he was performing at the Paramount way back in the early days, that only had a very young Nancy and a very young Frank. Tina wasn't even born yet. To a plastic kazoo that Nancy Jr. had given him when she was a little girl, to engraved gold keys to different houses that he had. I guess they were trying to figure out what could we possibly give Papa on Father's Day. And they would get a key to the house and have it made or plated in gold and then engrave it from all the kids. To a medallion from the people of Israel given to him by Golda Meir and Ben-Gurion, believe it or not, something that he did way back in 1947 before they were officially recognized as a state. To a gorgeous gold pocket watch given to him by, quote-unquote, the Emperor Mike Romanoff. These are just all some of these things had very little financial value at all, but personally and emotionally, they were all priceless and irreplaceable.
He had a couple things for you as well.
They weren't in the satchel. He felt the need, even though I told him, I said, you know, I'm proud and privileged and honored that you asked me to do this, and I'll take care of it. And he says, you know, I've thought about you as family, especially the last, you know, 8-10 years, and I want to prove it to you. And he went in the house, and he came back, and he handed me a small jewelry box. That I opened it up, and it was this pinky ring. Now, he had a couple. This particular ring, from what he told me, the story he told me, was the original, because when he married Barbara, he took the ring off his left hand, where he used to wear it, and tried to put it on his right hand. But he broke his hand, right hand, doing Manchurian Candidate. That coupled with a problem that he had with a nerve condition, his pinky on his right hand would not open completely, and he couldn't get this ring over the knuckle. So he had a replica of the ring made, and that's what he wore for the rest of his life, but he put this ring away. And he explained that to me as he gave it to me.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. And then I guess he was doing even more thinking about it after I left a week or so later and went back to L.A. And in his mind, knowing that I was a singer and it did pain me to give up my singing career, he knew that one of the things that I sorely missed was the possibility of making some noise as a vocalist, and the byproduct, obviously, would be to get a gold record or something like that. And I guess that was the logic behind him sending me a gold record. And he just, it was a very simple note. He said, this is for you. There's no discussion. And when I got back, I opened the package, and I saw this gold record. And instinctively, I picked up the phone. I called the house, and Vine, his housekeeper, Gal Friday, picked up the phone, and I said, is he up? She says, yeah, he's having his breakfast. I said, tell him I'm on the phone. I want to talk to him. She didn't put me on hold. That was too sophisticated a move for her. So she just pulled the phone away from me. She said, Mr. S, yeah, Tony O's on the phone. He wants to talk to you. Frank's response was, tell him to read the note again.
That's great. He knew what you were called. That's fantastic. You know, you mentioned his getting the stuff to his kids and his first wife. Now, I know he's very much in love with his fourth wife, Barbara, but there was a loyalty that remained with Nancy Sr., his first wife, as he would call her.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Truly, was that the love of his life? Was Nancy the love of his life? I mean, really?
You know, it's recently there was an article in a London paper that said Tony O reveals that Nancy Sr. was the love of his life. That's a question truly that only Frank could answer. All I can tell you, and I did say this, and they finally put quotes around what I did say, was that he remained very dedicated to her, had a strong, ongoing affection for her, despite being very much in love with Barbara. And I guess also you have to consider she supported him during his struggling years. She was the mother of his children.
Yeah.
He called her frequently for advice. In between wives, she was constantly a companion. They made trips together. They were very close friends. And at the end of the day, every single marriage begins and ends with that. If you don't have a strong friendship with your spouse, you got nothing. And so that's something that was there for his entire life, whether that was the true love of his life or not.
And Nancy's still around, by the way. She's 98.
God bless her. She's 98, still sharp. She's having a couple of minor health issues. She doesn't go out as much as she used to, but she's a sweetheart. She's a rock of Gibraltar. She's the glue. She held that family together through thick and thin, but most Italian ladies do.
All right. Well, there's more with producer, manager, and close friend of Frank Sinatra, Tony Opetisano, next on 720 WGN.
He sees you when you're sleeping. He knows when you're awake. He knows if you've been bad or good. So be good, for goodness sake.
Stay player on 720 WGN. We're celebrating 100 years of Frank Sinatra with manager and close friend Tony Opetisano. So you were there with Frank, really, mm-hmm. in his last moments when he uttered his last words.
Yeah. Yeah. It was again, something totally unexpected. I had been with him earlier in the day. I had spent the three previous days with him at the house. And that Thursday, it was the final episode of Seinfeld, which wasn't the total reason, but some friends of mine were moving out of state, and we agreed to get together for dinner and watch the closing episode of Seinfeld. And I told Frank, I said, listen, I'm not going to be around tonight, but I'm going to come back tomorrow, and I'll be with you through the whole weekend, because Barbara has some of her girlfriends coming up, and they're going out to the beach house, and we're going to be here at the house on Foothill Road in Beverly Hills. And something, I was compelled for some reason to go away from my own dinner thing and call the house to check on him. And he was already in the beginnings of part of an experience. And long story short, I left the house. He was taken by ambulance to Cedars. And when I got there and walked into the triage unit, they were already working on him feverishly. He was panicked, not panicked that he wasn't quite sure what was happening, but there was so much going on around him and so many people running around. I could see that he was a little bit shaken. And so I just was trying to keep him as calm as I possibly could in the hope that what the doctors were doing would have the desired result. Unfortunately, that was not to be. But he left peacefully, and he was at peace with himself, and that's basically all I can say.
83 years old.
So 82 and a half.
82 and a half.
82 and a half. He would have been 83 the following December. But he was 82 and a half going on 160.
Right.
I believe.
He did live an amazing life.
But even like he used to say, and I have adopted the phrase myself, I'm now 64. But as I tell people, well, my body's 64. I'm 29.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to say something similar. Trust me. There was still that young, hungry, wide-eyed, eager young man in there, even at 82 and a half. He loved animals. He loved nature. He's just, there was a lot more to the guy than the general public is even aware of. And little by little, I'm hoping that they see the other Frank Sinatra that very few people got to see.
All right. So, Tony, before I let you go, what would you say your fondest memory of Frank Sinatra is?
Oh, my God. I've got hundreds of them. You know, he was such a huge human being. And what I think I'd rather do instead of trying to rack my brain trying to find one is to tell you a story that'll give you a little bit of insight into Frank's sense of humanity and his philanthropy and his sense of humor all at the same time. We were in New York. This was in November. And it was cold and rainy and, you know, typical New York winter night. And Barbara had gone to see a matinee with a girlfriend of hers, and she called. They were going shopping after. She says, why don't we just meet uptown somewhere or midtown somewhere for a bite of food? So he had her pick a restaurant, blah, blah, blah. And, okay, sweetheart, we'll see you at 8 o'clock. And so we get ready to leave the Waldorf Towers. We get in a limousine, and we're driving uptown. We stop at a traffic light. And right across from where we were stopped, on the right-hand side of the street, there was a lady, probably middle-aged lady, trying to sell flowers in the rain out of these empty paint buckets. Mm-hmm. And Frank said, tell Maddie, the driver, to pull over as soon as we cross the light. So we did. And he says, come on. And he gets out of the car. I get out of the car. It's raining. And this woman had her back to us. And he said, sweetheart, how much for the whole lot? And she turned around, and she saw him, and she said, oh, my God. She says, for you, Mr. Sinatra, $100. Okay, sweetheart. And he took out his money, and he gave the woman like $500 or $600. And he said, now do me a favor. He says, go home, get out of this damn weather, go home and have a hot meal. And we took the paint buckets and we put them inside the limousine, get back in the car. And he says, why don't you take us up to Sloan Kettering, the cancer hospital? And it was up on the Upper East Side, way away from where we were supposed to go for dinner. And I said, Frank, you know we're going to be late. He says, yeah. And so we pulled into the emergency entrance, and he had security guards come over to the car. And when they saw him, they smiled, and he gave them each $100. And he said, do me a favor, guys, would you bring these flowers up to the pediatric ward for me? So now we're driving to the restaurant, and it's about 20 minutes after 8, 25 minutes after 8. And I says, you know, Barbara's going to be pissed. He says, that's all right. We'll deal with it. We walk into the restaurant. She shoots him a look.
I'm sure.
And Frank says to her, he said, sorry, sweetheart, I am so sorry, but it's not my fault, it's Tony. And she looks over at me, and Frank said, the kids are drunk. Between here and the Waldorf, we had to stop at three different bars for a shot.
He threw you under the bus.
I looked at him, I said, thanks a lot.
But what it really does, outside of that, it really tells you what a charitable guy he was. And I've heard stories like that, and I'm sure you've got hundreds of them. I mean, he was a pretty charitable guy. I mean, he really did think about other people.
Yeah. Yes, he was. Always thinking about other people. He used to say, you know, you come into this world with nothing, you leave with nothing, he said, and the only good of having money is if it can make your life and the lives of people you care about and other people happy.
So true.
And you make more.
That's right.
He says, Tony, let me tell you something. He says, I learned this a long time ago. He says, and you'll find out that it's true. I've never seen a Brinks truck at a cemetery.
That's a good point. That's a good point. Tony, I got to tell you, what a pleasure spending some time with you tonight. You know, I know you really never do interviews, so this I know how special this is. And as we celebrate 100 years of Frank Sinatra, I couldn't think of anybody else I'd like to have join us tonight. So thank you so much.
Thanks for asking. I'm flattered and I'm honored. And everyone, have a drink to Frank on December 12th.
A little Jack.
Jack and water on Jack. The rocks in a bucket.
In a bucket.
Yeah, well, you know, yes, I swear to God, I walk at the bars and I said, you have any buckets? And they look at me. It truly is an oversized rocks glass, but these days I guess there are not that many bars that have them anymore, so they think I'm making a joke.
Well, I do,
but,
too.
You know. I have seen Frank pour a drink in a real bucket.
Yeah, I'm sure you have. That's a whole other story. All right, Tony. Happy holidays to you, my friend.
Thank you, Dave. Take care of yourself.
His mother and father are sitting on the porch in Nebraska going, why doesn't Johnny call? And his father is not that way. Your dad is, what, about 6'2"?
No.
Your father. Try to think.
Yes. My dad.
See, when you get that rich, you forget the family. He's so busy in court all day long going, well, who wants to sue?
Look. Now, John, you've had, not lucky in love, but now, thank God, you've met the woman of
yes.
your dreams. Really.
Well. And, hey, folks, we don't know. He just calls Ed and I and says, I met the woman of my dreams. And for his success, we go, fine, John.
Ned, you've had, you know, never lucky in love, but you're both handsome guys. I'm married 9 years. I want to be with you guys so bad.
But you didn't get married. I got a Jewish wife didn't... that just lays in bed and goes, help me with the jewelry. Now, don't write letters. You taught me that. Don't write letters.
Now, you didn't get married, though, until you were late in life.
Well, till I was what?
Well, I mean...
I was 38 years old before
well,
I got
married. Now, that's kind of long, isn't it?
Hey, but you know, we discussed this before, and Ed, you know, well, you guys got married, your first marriages, and I'm not being sarcastic.
38?
Well, I got news. When you're kids, you come out of college. I never went to college. I come up the hard way. You guys just skyrocketed. But I came out of the neighborhood, and they went, what do you mean abroad? And the broad was always like me, you know. But actually, what happened was I met the most darling lady in life late in life because I worked with strippers, exotic dancers, as we call them today. You know, with the cobra coming out of the basket, and the cobra went, I want to be with you. And the broad went, challenge me, challenge me. It's a long story, and I was on the road a lot. Laying in bed watching a moth die on the lamb, you know.
And when you get like that, you find yourself on a street corner going, Miss. And then I met my wife, who said, I'm not some perverted jerk, I'm a person. And now she's sitting at home, just laying there, going, he's so rich, he's so rich. See, they always say Jewish people have a lot of money. You're an Irish guy, right?
That's right.
Well, you never would have money because you're too busy spending it on beer. You just sit around the house in your bathroom going, bleh.
We are backstage in Las Vegas at the Orleans Hotel and Casino with a comedy legend that has entertained us for nearly 65 years. He's an actor, a comedian, an author, an Emmy Award winner. Don has performed for four U.S. presidents, traveled the world with his lovely wife Barbara and his best friends Bob and Ginny Newhart. I thought I'd drop his name in there.
Good. No, he'll check that out.
I'm sure he will. And that is the legendary Don Rickles. Don, good evening and happy 90th birthday to you.
I always say me and Harry Truman, May 8th.
May 8th, that's the day. And I wanted to talk about your very beginnings. The very beginnings that developed into the Don Rickles we know today. You were the class clown, not great in school. You were the president of your high school class. Where did you get your sense of humor?
Well, you know, I really don't know. My mother was not a person that did humor. She had great personality. My father was a terrific salesman, but not a jokester, so to speak. It just came, from being around guys. I was always, even in the Navy, and well, that's further on in my life. But when I was a very young guy, I always kidded around in school, and it became me. I really don't have a basis to say, well, my Uncle Charlie or something. But it's not so. I just, my mother encouraged it, you know, to kid around, not dreaming I would be doing
sure.
this.
Friends, family members,
yeah,
that
right.
type of thing.
Get up at the party, at the bar mitzvah, at the wedding, and say something.
Now, you left the Navy at the end of the war, and thank you for your service, by the way. Oh. You went to school at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, class of 48, with the likes of Grace Kelly, Jason Robards, Anne Bancroft, Charles Durning. Very prestigious school.
It was, and I was very fortunate because they said I'd never attain that because I was always kind of loud and strong. And there was a guy called Phil Loeb, rest his soul. Look how I remember his name yeah. now. He's a great director, and he passed away. And and I used to go, good evening, you know, from the stage and all. And he'd say, take it easy, take it easy. He said, but never lose that energy. And that energy was the basis of my humor, and that helped me a great deal.
That and attitude.
Yeah. Well, see, my whole humor is based on not so much the joke, really, but, of course, it's the attitude of what I say.
You're not a joke teller. I mean,
no.
you know, I've heard you
Thank
say,
you.
If you give me $1 million and go on stage, you know, you're a comedian, but you're not a joke teller. You did some impressions for a while.
Yes, I did.
In the early days.
Oh, God, yes.
But talking to the audience is really what made you who you were.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. And everything I've done to this very day, except for television, everything I've done on the stage is what I created in the car, in the house, the bathroom.
Yeah.
It's never been written on paper.
Right.
And I just added and added and kept saying it. Gave a performance.
Sure. And there was no Comedy Central. There was no Comedy Store, no Tonight Show when you got started. Comedians worked other venues. You worked burlesque houses and strip clubs.
Yeah. I worked at what they call strip joints with the girls, Satina, taking off her clothes. And those days, there was not that much clothes taken off. And I was like the comedian in
yeah.
between, you know,
yeah.
with the talking, again, talking to the audience and making stupid jokes and throwing in a few impressions. And that's how I kept going and joining terrible places, believe me.
And there are places, three names that I've always heard you talk about, and in your book, too. The three places were Slate Brothers, Murray Franklin's, and the Copacabana. The three names are always Johnny Carson, Frank Sinatra, and Dean Martin. And I want to first talk to you a little bit about the Slate Brothers.
Yeah, well, there was a guy called Henry Slate, rest his soul. He was a good guy, and I worked for, like, Peanuts, and I used to get dressed in the kitchen. You know, the fellow called Harry Gomes, rest his soul, who was with me for 40 years.
Yeah, yeah.
And he used to help me get dressed in the kitchen. I always wanted to wear a tuxedo. That was my thing.
Yeah. And a real bow tie.
Yeah. And I worked at and the Slate Brothers was like a little store.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, I started to do what I do, making fun of people. And suddenly, stars started to show up little by little, you know. And they said, oh, Sinatra was in the other night, and Rickles did blah, blah, blah. Senator Charlton Heston came by, you know. And I used to do stuff about these and women and so forth. And it caught on, and it was exciting time.
Well, they wanted to be insulted by you. I mean, they caught on that was cool.
And, you know, they used the word insult, and it's an attitude. It's not mean-spirited. I've never, in my opinion, never hurt anybody. You know, I never hit below the belt or anything. Even when it came to a mobsters who come to see me in those days.
Sure.
And so I made jokes about them, but they laughed because it was kind and it was funny.
And you
made Mickey Cohn, he used to arrest us. So he used to come in and sit. I don't think Tony ever knew this. And he used to sit in the front with his dog. He had a dog. And he put the dog in the chair and sit there and laughed his hands on. And I would kid about the dog and so forth.
Of course you would.
That's what he did. He thought it was a riot.
That's great. And I know Murray Franklin's came along, and your mother, your dear mother, God rest her soul, played a big part in getting Frank to come see you at Murray Franklin's.
Yeah, well, she went up to Dolly up at the Fontainebleau, I say, in the performance. And spoke to her and said, if you get to Frank to see my Donnie, she called me Donnie. And she said, don't Etta, it was her name. Don't worry, Etta, I'll take care of her. And sure enough, a couple of nights later, Frank came in with a few of his friends, and that was it, you know.
And Murray Franklin's was in Miami.
Yeah, it was, and when I say it on the stage, I think I'm kidding. It was a rocking chair. That was the theme, all rocking chairs. And to this day, well, Murray's in another world now, but in those days he said, look at the crowd I'm drawing, meaning him. And I always went along with that.
He kind of felt like he was the Ed Sullivan, really, of Miami, didn't he?
Yeah, he was. It was a big shot. Yeah.
But this is where, you know, Frank Sinatra, nobody messed with Frank Sinatra.
It's all over, Frank. I know you don't like to hear that. It's gone.
They said, Frank Sinatra's here, and I've never met him, you know. And I get the chill.
You'll excuse us, won't you?
Certainly, certainly. Marco Mangananzo was hurt.
Marco Mangananzo?
Fambino Bombazzo. Two bullets in the head Thursday. Now this you don't believe. Excuse us, Johnny. You're from the Midwest. You're busy going. Is the truck loaded? Guido says hi. He hasn't had a chance to talk to you. And from Jersey City, your good friend Bubani Umbatsa.
What's his
name? He started his car. He started his car with your album on, and now he's a highway.
What else is new, Frank?
Well, I'll tell you what's new.
The following report to an alley in Brooklyn. Manganzo Mambananzo. Un papi gumbaninzi. Alto Gumbananzo.
Now cut that out.
That's a cancel. See, with Frank, if I may say, Frank, because you've been singing and dancing and just breaking it up out here. With Frank, they always make it like gangsters, Italians are gangsters, Jews have all the money. Well, that's a fact. But...
Well, where's Barbara? Where is she?
Barbara's in the dressing room going, it's an exciting night.
Is it true you keep her in the vault?
That's a good one, Frank.
That's good.
Anyway.
Well, he enjoyed me. I mean, we could have been having dinner. As I always say, and he'd say, and you know, when I was in Europe, or boom, when I say, pass the rolls, and he'd say, pass the rolls. Then he'd say, you know, and I said, Frank, I'm talking. And he'd start to laugh, his can off, he'd fall on the floor. When I talk, I said, pass the rolls, I don't care about Europe. And he loved it.
And there was the Copa as well that you've talked about before, New York's most famous nightclub.
Yeah, I had great success there. A fellow called Willie Weber and Joe Scandori. Willie Weber was the beginning, then Joe Scandori, who knew a lot of guys. And he talked to me, and I went to see Juice Podell, and he said, and I always used to do an impression, this kid will never work the Copacabana. I don't need nobody calling people jerks and dummies and hockey pucks. I always was clean up to this day.
Yeah,
never been.
Yeah, you know. That's never found my
not that I, hey, guys that are doing it and are making a lot of money and are successful, I'm not against it. I'm all for it if you can do that. But I never did. And so I went, and Podell said, you're never going to work here. Dissolved. My manager made a phone call to a couple of guys, and 2 days later, Podell said, Tub Rickles, come over, I want to have a drink with him. I said, Joe, the guy just, he said, don't worry about it. And when he said, I want to tell you, kid, you are the funniest son of a bitch in the world. Nobody can top you, and you're going to be the star here at the Copa, and it's going to be your home. I love. Pick on me. Whatever.
So
that's the way it started.
So at the Copa in New York, you're entertaining mobsters quite a bit.
Yeah.
And there was Joey Gallo you were entertaining. And I love the story. Your mother walked up to him and told him and his friends to put their guns on the table before you hit the stage.
Yeah. Well, it was in the lounge.
Yeah.
He wanted me to come over and have a drink with him. And she said, I'll go over first. I'm up. She said, don't worry about it. And Joey's going to sweetheart. They all liked her. Darling Joey, don't worry, sweetheart. Just have the guys put the guns. I don't want to see the guns. They put the guns on the table. And I went over and kibitzed with him. And, unfortunately, he invited us that night. And that night, his whole crew got taken care of, unfortunately.
People loved your mother, and she really took care of you. She really watched out for you.
Oh, yeah. She never really caught on to my humor. She said, Joe used to say, why can't you be like Alan King? And Alan, rest his soul, is gone. But, I always used to say, why do you bring it? Because, or Shecky Green, whom she adored, too.
Yeah.
She said, why can't you be like them? My God. And then I started to make money. She said, you know, you're clever. Something there that you're clever.
She got on.
She never was, she always worried about it. But.
We'll continue my conversation with legendary comedian Don Rickles next on 720 WGN.
I ever have trouble with my... No. The biggest argument I had with my wife, she said to me, I want to tell you something very honestly. That's the kind of wife... Am I right, Johnny? Am I right, Ed? I married a value. And on the wedding night, she went, is that about it? I married within my range. Let me put it to you.
In your species.
I didn't go overboard with the other broads like some of my black brothers that go, yeah! You know,
yeah.
Jews don't do that. They said, well, start in a minute. I'm going to go get a paper.
I'm a nice guy. In spite of what you heard, I'm a nice guy. You can fetch a little bird.
It's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. My conversation with the legendary Don Rickles on his 90th birthday continues.
TV producers at the time thought you were too hot to handle, but on the night of October 7th, 1965, you made your first appearance on The Tonight Show, over 100 appearances, as we were saying, over 3 decades. How did you first meet Johnny? How did that all come about?
Well, it was in New York. I don't exactly know how we met, but he heard about me in the Elegante. That was the place my manager owned, and I was very successful there, and people used to come and see. So, you know, word got around, and then his people asked if I'd come on the show. And we hit it off great. From the very day we met, if the paper said, that's the time when, if the paper said, we're going to talk about trains tonight, and you'd look at the paper and said, how's your mother, you know? And I'd say, you never liked my mother. Why do you bring that up? And we'd start to do 20 minutes about mothers, you know?
Yeah.
And your mother never liked me. Why is that? You know? And he was great. He picked right up on it. And it was that fun.
And he was the kind of guy that made you funny. He was a great setup artist, and he wanted you to shine.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And Johnny was pretty much, socially, was kind of a loner, you know.
Yeah,
we went out socially occasionally, but he wasn't a guy that participated. He was uncomfortable with a lot of people, and yet when the light went on, he was the best.
What's the worst place you ever worked? I mean, when you were
here.
Just starting. Every time you travel with your wife, you always seem to travel with Bob and Ginny Newhart. Is there a reason for that?
Well, yeah, because
I know
he pays for everything.
No, he doesn't.
No, not really. No, I travel with Newhart because Bob and I have nothing in common. Bob, to me, is, you know, like, it's like being in a room with a dead fly.
Don't worry, Ed. You're going to be big.
This, hey, eventually, if Johnny retires, are you going to retire?
Certainly.
No, you're not. No, you're not. I know what your wife spends. You are not retiring. He's got a wife that just sits up in Bel Air. She was an airline hostess, had nothing. Now she goes, send in another box.
Now,
I know. And
who opens for who?
Well, naturally, Frank opens for me.
I see. I told that joke to Frank. And ever since then, I can't find my aunt in the Bronx.
And the Bronx, eh?
In the Bronx.
Same with David Letterman. And I know it was...
Letterman had that thing, too.
Yeah. Did you, in the earlier days of knowing Johnny, did you hang out with him more really in the 60s a little bit more?
No, it was never hanging out with Johnny. It was a dinner date or doing the show and have dinner with him afterwards.
Okay.
Or when his birthday came, we were at the house and a few people. But he was very, very, very close with his life.
Yeah. He had notes, like I do, for every interview, but he never... And I never saw him at once in any of the footage I saw glance at the notes.
No. Well, he knew what he'd be up in the dressing room. He knew what he was going
to do.
Yeah.
Did he give you the name Mr. Warmth?
Yeah, he did.
He did.
Which I love.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, Milton Berle, rest his soul, who was my idol when I was a kid. He was one of the king of insult, and a lot of people called me Insult Charlie, Insult This. And I hated the word insult, and some people still say, but it's not an insult, it's a put-on. It's exaggerating about all of us, you know. That's what I do. And Johnny made it Mr. Warmth, which was great, which has really stuck for me.
Just something you mentioned about Milton. You know, I know people have asked in the past, who was your mentor? Who did you look up to as far as in comedy and so forth? You said Milton was always just an inspiration more on his timing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Great timing. And when I was a kid, he was the guy for me. I adored Milton, even in his later years.
Part of the Carson experience in every performance since is your song. Where did the song come from?
Oh, a guy called Key Howard, I think. He was a piano player that used to be with me. And he wrote it.
And that was
it? You can sing, you can do it. And I've been doing it.
And you've been doing it. You got away with the same type of rippers that you had with Sinatra, with Johnny, telling him...
You've been married.
Yes. All right.
But,
you like the way I set this up for you? I'll just feed him in. You take
the
snappers.
No, because I know all your wives, you know. And now you're very, very... Well, I did. They were all friends of mine, and they're friends of yours. And
yes.
Until you got in court and said, you're going to take what? I mean, there's a limit.
But that was part of your relationship with him on the air.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was always a put-down and fun, you know. And he always enjoyed it. He really did. And he was a great, he was the kind of guy, when something didn't work, he always made it funny. He had a great feel for comedy, he really did.
Do you have not so much a popular moment, but do you have a favorite moment out of, you know, 100 plus appearances on the show that you love talking about an experience you had on the air with Johnny? Like, what was your favorite?
Well, I can't see, there were so many wonderful times.
Yeah.
There was a time when he threw me into the pool.
The Japanese.
That was talked about a great deal.
Yeah.
And there was one other time when I...
Well, with Sinatra, you know, when Frank was on the show, and he didn't make a lot of appearances on The Tonight Show, but then you walked out on stage.
That was another time. It's on the film, in the show here tonight.
One of my favorite moments of all time. Share with us that story that Frank told about you. You weren't married to Barbara yet. You were dating a pretty girl, and you walked over to Frank's table.
It's funny you should say that, because the wife said to me upstairs, "Don, stop telling that story."
Did she really?
I swear
to God.
It's
the best story. I love that story.
Everybody in the world, newspaper people, everybody picked up on that story. One guy said it happened in Shanghai. One guy said it happened in China. One guy said it happened in North Korea. I mean, from a little story like that.
Yeah.
And it's true. The punchline is, you know, it's with this girl, blah, blah, blah. I wanted to score with her, and he was in the coat, in the sands, in the lounge. I went over and said, he called me Bullethead. I said, Frank, he said, what is Bullethead? I said, if you could come over and help me out with the girl, blah, 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 blah. Okay, not right away. But don't worry. Okay. And so I sat down with her, and she said, do you know Frank Sinatra? I said, oh, sweetheart, come on. But sure enough, she was put in getting all supports there. He came over and said, hey, Don, how are you? And I said, hey, Frank, can't you see I'm eating? and he fell out living. Then he had the security cops, which nobody even knew, picked me up and carried me out.
More of my conversation with the legendary Don Rickles next on 720 WGN.
Yeah, Dean used me. The big break with Dean was once with Roy Rogers, which was a fun show. And if you know Roy, he was a guy, you know, that you know, he would laugh at grass growing. So, but it was a sweet man. And we had a lot of stuff to bounce off with him. But the big thing was they turned around and had me go with all stars in the audience. They brought about 15, 25 stars. And they said, Don, just let the cameras roll and you make it up and pick on all these people.
Ernie Borgnine's laughing. Big Academy Award winner. Remember you and Marty? He was so brilliant in Marty, and today it's over. Like that. Go figure this business. Baby Rosemary, so many years I've known you. Remember the old days? You, Mary Small, are all in there. And now your career is slowly sinking into the... Look at this. Bob Newhart just said to the wife, he's not going to mention me.
Now, ladies and gentlemen... It's time for revenge. Here's our man of the week, the merchant of venom, Mr. Don Rickles.
It takes many years to be a great comedian.
It sure does, and you ain't reached that year yet.
Thank you, Jerry.
I could say anything because at 12:30 nobody's up.
No, there's there's a fine group of folks out there.
No, you have a good
this.
Following. I never thought you were going to make it. I'm delighted for you. I was one of the guys that said this guy's a stiff. He ain't going to make it.
Look at the way the whole crew, especially the Chinaman, he's going. Anyway, I say that with endearment. We need you people. Yeah. So the Jews have a place to eat on Sunday.
Exactly.
What could you do to me? Anyway, so we had to hold it down in the balcony, otherwise Lincoln's gonna get it.
It's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN, and now the conclusion to my conversation backstage in Vegas with Mr. Warmth himself, the legendary Don Rickles.
There was another story, and I've only heard you tell it once, and I don't even remember what show it was on, and I was a kid when I heard the story, and you were talking about being with Jilly Rizzo, and after a performance, you guys were sitting down having some vodka, some Jack Daniels, whatever it was at the time, and there was thunder.
Yeah.
Outside and lightning. Share with us that story.
Yeah. Well, it was in Italy. We were sitting in a hotel and at the big bay window. You know, boom, 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 boom. Lights were going, thunder and rain. And frankly, we were all having vodka, just the three of us. And he kept saying, "Tell those reporters to stop." And it was raining. I said, "Well, Frank, no. Don't check me around. I want you to go out, you and Jillian. Tell them to stop it. I want to stop." Because the lightning was coming into them. And we had tuxedos on.
Yeah.
We went out soaking wet in the rain. "Now, you people, stop it. Stop it. Just stop it." It's true. And we came back in the room soaking wet. And thank God the rain stopped. I sat down and Frank said, "That's class. I appreciate it."
Very nice.
And we were soaking wet.
Johnny had you guest host several times, too. Did you enjoy that experience?
Yeah. Wasn't my really cup of tea, but it was a treat. It was.
Well, I will tell you, I'm 48 years old, and I remember in the 70s being 10, 12 years old, and when I heard Don Rickles was on, I'd come downstairs and I'd kind of hide around the corner so I could watch you on the Tonight Show.
Thank you.
Oh, my gosh, absolutely. The Johnny Carson Comedy Award, years later, you were the second to receive it, presented by Robert De Niro and Jon Stewart. With Johnny's name on there, what did that mean to you?
Oh, great. It's a microphone I have.
I
have it at home. I have a room called the Mr. Warmth Room.
That's cool.
A fella in Minneapolis, he named it after me. So put it on my dressing room. And so now we have that plaque. Anyway, so it was that really impressed me. And Johnny gave me, they presented me with this microphone, which I was very happy about.
And you do it in front of Johnny's curtains, which only make an appearance now once a year at these comedy awards.
Yeah,
that's right. Pretty cool to see something so vintage.
Yeah, right.
You know, be there. You were in some of the biggest movies, ranging from Run Silent, Run Deep with Gable and Lancaster, The Rat Race with Tony Curtis, Kelly's Heroes, which is a personal favorite.
Hello, Hogan. Scrap game. I got you the scotch and the nylons you wanted. Yeah. Do I ever fail you? You better believe it. Never miss. Listen, I got a little favor to ask of you.
Will you stop crying? I haven't even asked you yet.
Martin Scorsese's Casino with Robert De Niro and Sharon Stone. That was a favorite. I mean, you must have loved that because you really were, you represented Vegas in one of the biggest movies.
It's funny you should say it because, Martin, there was really no part for me. And Scorsese called me and said, you're going to be Billy Sherbet. And he sent me the script. They said, there's no Billy Sherbet in it. He said, don't worry about it. You're in the movie. And he put me in the thing. He said, because your image represents what I want to sell. And so I was part of that movie. And we had a good time doing it, you know. And my experience was always De Niro. And first time I worked with him, he said, you know, Bob's very serious. Don't kid around, blah, blah, blah. And I met him at his house. He was doing Cape Fear. He had the hair.
Oh, yeah.
Then I went and... on the first scene, we were walking down there. At night for night shooting, it was tough in those days.
I bet.
In the casino at the Riviera, and walking down, and they said, Roland, and Bob went, yeah, so I took the gun, and I said to the guy, you know, where's it going to go? And I said, I can't, Marty, I can't work with this man, he's a mumbler.
He was there when the mob ran Vegas. He was caught just after the Rat Pack. And yes, he knew Sinatra, and he managed to say it in every sense he ever said. Yeah, I knew Frank. Frank loved me. There was Frank in my front row. Frank always came to see me. I told Frank this. I told Frank that. I'm so sick of hearing about Frank Sinatra. Enough already. It made me want to tell Frank to go himself. I mean, I don't know how to tell you this, Don, but Frank is dead. Coincidentally, dead is also the average age of your fans.
Man, I'm making $80 billion there. Got to work with that goofball and mumbling. I'm walking. I don't need this. De Niro started laughing. We became great friends.
You carried him in that movie.
Absolutely.
You absolutely did. And then for your grandchildren, you know, Disney's Toy Story franchise, Toy Story 4 coming in 2018. Yeah. You've been part of every bit
17
of
17 years, yeah.
Hey, Ham, look, I'm Picasso.
I don't get it.
You uncultured swine. What are you looking at, you hockey puck?
My 10-year-old, when we watched Toy Story over Christmas, over the holidays, said, that sounds like Don Rickles, my 10-year-old.
Yeah.
Because she knows who you are.
Yeah. Oh,
that's
my God.
That's pretty important. TV appearances, I just remember watching in the 60s. You were all over the place. It was the Dick Van Dyke Show, the Twilight Zone, the Munsters,
my life, yeah.
Adam's Family, Get Smart, your pal Don Adams, the Lucy Show, Andy Griffith, I Dream of Jeannie. You were all over the place. And then later, you know, Larry Sanders and Hot in Cleveland, your own show, CPO Sharky, Daddy Dearest. You've really seen and done it all. You really have.
Well, thank you. Yeah. My dream is I had a couple of good dramatic parts, but in movies I wanted to be more part of it. But I got so fortunate in working in this world of stand-up that I pretty much stayed with it.
But, yeah.
I always enjoyed when I was in a movie.
And now we're backstage in Vegas. Your debut was at the Sahara Hotel. Do you remember walking on stage in Vegas for that first time in 1958, almost 60 years ago?
I really don't remember.
No, is that right?
But my tough days were in the lounge. I used to work in the lounge.
Yeah.
Three shows a night, 12, 2, and 5 in the morning.
Wow.
With guys eating over a bar.
Yeah.
And I did what I do, you know. Yeah. Oh, you got eggs on your face. Use a napkin, you know. That was the act. You know?
Yeah.
And they all came in to see me. Yeah.
But you played these places. You talked about the strip clubs. You played. You performed for the mafia. How did you not end up in a trunk?
I never hit below the belt. Really. Every wise guy that ever knew me, and I knew some tough guys. But my manager, Joe Scandori, rest his soul, he said, you don't have to know that. I never knew last names. I knew Charlie. I knew Joe. Yeah. I knew Frankie. I knew Tony. But he would never say the guy's name. Never say the last name. It was good.
What has changed the most about Vegas over the years?
The big production shows now. Personalities are little by little disappearing unless you're really top of the mark.
Sure.
And I came from the world when it was a lot of individuals. Now it's the big ballets and the big shows, you know, which is fine, but it's a different world.
And the big mobs, I mean, they control a lot of Vegas, but they were always very good to you. They were always very good to you.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I wanted to tell you this last story. Every time I see you, you always say, hey, you know, you're a young guy, keep the name out there. My son is almost 16, and on a recent road trip with some buddies, we threw on Don Rickles in the car. Don Rickles and Carson, Letterman, the Reagan inaugural, the Dean Martin roast. I think we did Don Adams' birthday party, whatever we could find, because we were on the road forever. And these guys, these young guys, laughed their ass off. And when we got home, there were the fathers that came up to me and shook my hand and said, thank you for introducing my son to Don Rickles. Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool.
I think that's very nice.
Yeah. Really, what would you like, you know, the generation that grew up with you, which is like me, what would you like me to tell the next generation and more of these young kids about Don Rickles?
That was a guy that was interested in making the people laugh. The people, and to do things they understood, and to do things that are happening in their life, and projected and exaggerated. That's it.
The legendary Don Rickles, thank you, and again, happy 90th birthday to you.
Well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
He was born and raised in Lynchburg, Tennessee.
All right, it's Dave Flyer back with you on 720 WGN. So all the way back to 1866, Jasper Jack Daniel had the foresight to place his very own distillery at a source of limestone water flowing from a cave spring in Lynchburg, Tennessee. And 150 years later, Jack Daniel's has been at the forefront of whiskey making ever since. Now, Jack Daniel's assistant master distiller has a passion for this business, and most importantly, this iconic brand that has been handed down from generation to generation, as his grandfather was the master distiller for almost three decades, beginning in the late 60s. And to celebrate the 150th anniversary of the Jack Daniel's Distillery, live in studio is Jack Daniel's assistant master distiller, and that is Chris Fletcher. Chris, thanks for hanging out with us tonight.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm born and raised in Lynchburg, Tennessee. My parents' house is just down the street from the distillery, so I definitely kind of grew up in the shadows
you
of
did.
The distillery a
yeah.
bit. My granddad was the distiller there for many years, and so, you know, I was a young guy. I was tagging along with him. A lot of times on Sunday afternoons, he would have to go in and set yeast for the next week's production for the fermentations, and so I'll tag along. And
Chris,
you know,
come along.
Yeah, come along.
That's
and, you know,
awesome.
Sunday night, you couldn't get into much trouble, right, running around. So
not at all.
But it was fun. You know, I didn't really understand that, you know, my granddad was in charge of making whiskey. You know, at the time, it was just fun time to be with Papa, you know, and spend some time with him. And I can certainly remember, you know, the sights, the smells, and so going to work every day now, I've got his old wooden desk from his old office.
Oh, how cool is that?
It's really cool. It's a special thing for sure.
And you talk about just making whiskey. You're making Jack Daniel's whiskey. I mean, that's the cool stuff right there.
Well, we think so.
You know,
Lynchburg, Tennessee is a town of only about 600 people, and, you know, there's a lot of families, not just myself and my granddad. You know, there's a lot of folks back home in Lynchburg that are great whiskey makers, and it's really, truly been passed down in our town from generation to generation.
Now, one of the world's most iconic brands. Let's first talk about the man himself, who Jack Daniel was.
Right. Well, Jack, he was born in Lynchburg as well. Grew up, he was the youngest of 13 children in his family, and his mom actually passed away very young age,
yeah.
As just a young child. And, you know, he didn't get along very well with his stepmother. And his father actually passed away again, you know, when he was still a boy. And he ended up running away, you know, not getting along with his stepmom. And he lived with the Call family. The Calls were a family there in Lynchburg. And Dan Call was the head of the house, and he was kind of a businessman. He had a farm and a still. He made whiskey. He ran a store, and he was also a minister. at our Lutheran
church.
I
like the combination right
there. Yeah, and so Jack, he learned, you know, as a young guy, learning the trade of making whiskey on Dan Call's farm, and it ended
when
up...
When he was young.
Yes, absolutely.
He was very young.
Yeah, very young guy, and ended up getting that still from Dan Call because the church kind of gave Mr. Call the ultimate...
Hard time.
Yeah, they didn't think it was a good idea to do both, and so that's how Jack ended up on his own there in Lynchburg.
Now, the distillery is located in and around a hollow where spring flows from a limestone cave. Explain all that.
Right. Yeah, it's, you know, it's true. You know, you see these ads and everything, and people think, well, it must be some kind of Hollywood set or something, but it's not. It really is Lynchburg. It's a tiny town, 600 people. The distillery sits at the mouth of a cave spring. So there's a large hill, and kind of surrounded on three sides of a hill. That's what we call a hollow, or I guess a holler. You know, some people say a holler.
Holler, yeah.
But at the mouth of that is the cave spring. And so this spring, it comes from underground. So it's an underground water source. And this water, if you think about back in Jack's time, the mid-1800s, there was no city water system in Lynchburg, right?
No filtering at
all.
And
so the hard thing to find to make whiskey was good water. And so when he found that spring... That's when he set up shop there in 1866. He was about 16 years old when he did
that.
That's
crazy. Mm-hmm. That's crazy. Now, one of the original buildings at the distillery that dates back to the days of Jasper Daniel still stands there today, right?
It does. It does. We have one old building remaining, the old office building.
That's can go into, or is it one you just admire from the outside?
No, you get to go in.
Oh, that's
absolutely
cool.
We get tours every single day. Yeah. We have lots of visitors from all over the world that love. A lot of people from, you know, international countries, they plan their visit to the U.S., and Lynchburg, Tennessee is one of their, you know, premier stops. It's like Chicago, New York, and Lynchburg.
That's awesome. It's funny. That's awesome. Now, contrary to popular belief, Jack Daniel's being just one whiskey, there's actually multiple varieties of whiskey. Old Number 7, Tennessee Honey, Gentleman Jack, and Jack Daniel's Single Barrel, correct?
Right. Yep. Those are all variations of our whiskey.
Yeah. And I was looking at some of these facts here. The Jack Daniel's plant was only closed. It was closed a couple of times, once obviously for Prohibition. Did they make anything? Because a lot of these places that used to make whiskey made something else during Prohibition. Did they make anything else, or did they just shut it down at that time?
We did not. We completely shut down. And at that time, Jack had just passed away, and he had actually
passed it on to his nephews.
To his nephews, that's right. You got it. So,
and then during World War II, it was kind of a government thing that the resources needed to be redirected elsewhere.
Right. What happened there, sometime early mid-40s, the government started rationing grain. And, of course, whiskey being made from cereal grain. And in Lynchburg, we've only used number one grain, which is the most premium you can find. And back in World War II, they wouldn't let you distill and make alcohol out of number one grade corn. They wanted that to only go into food products. And so the Motlow family, Jack's nephew, said, hey, if we can't get number one grain, we're not going to make Jack Daniel's. And so that was the second time and the only other time we haven't made whiskey.
So Lem Motlow, his nephew, ran the business for really almost 40 years, nonstop, right?
Right, yes. We owe Mr. Lem Motlow a lot because, you know, he was actually a state congressman in Tennessee. So when Prohibition was repealed in Tennessee, that was 1938. We were a little behind the time on the rest of the country there. Mm-hmm. But Mr. Lem Motlow, he was the one that was able to get our distilled spirits permit renewed to make whiskey because we're still actually in
a dry town.
Yeah,
I know that.
It's dry.
I know that. Wild.
Yep.
Wild. Now, according to Daniel's biographer that I read, the origin of the Old Number 7 was the number assigned to the distillery for government registration. Is that true?
There's a lot of stories on that, and I'll be honest with you. Nobody really knows the truth.
A secret that died with Jack.
It did, you know. I've heard people say, you know, one day hopefully they're going to be able to meet Mr. Jack maybe in another life, and that'll be the first question they'll ask him. So, but we don't know the true story, the true meaning behind the number seven. So
now you're in this, you know, 150 years. This is a 1,700-acre operation, about 435 workers, and you ship out 119 million bottles in a year.
Yeah, it's probably about right. You know, when it gets to the bottling side of it, you know, as a distiller, we're not that involved. So when you talk about quantities of bottles, I don't know. But barrels and things is kind of where we're at, you know, in my end of the process.
So what are you doing every day? Like, what is a day like as a master distiller, assistant master distiller? What do you do every day?
Yeah, well, you know, my role is, you know, I report to Jeff Arnett, our master distiller, and, you know, really the best way to think about it is kind of a quality control position. You know, we're there as a resource to, you know, if there seems to be any issues or any variants or anything like that, we're there to taste the product, smell the product, you know, make sure that the grain coming in maintains the quality, make sure that our barrels are being made with the quality that we want. Because at Jack Daniel's, we control everything that goes into the whiskey. So when we buy that grain and we source our grain out of the Midwest mostly, and once that comes into the distillery, we're doing all of our own work on all parts of the process. So we have our own yeast, that we have people that keep our yeast fresh for our fermentation. We design our own stills and we make our own barrels. And so everything that goes into the flavor, the quality of the whiskey is purposefully done in Lynchburg to make Jack Daniel's what it is.
Now, is it true that you've got the single barrel whiskey that we're going to try after the break here, but the U.S. military buys the most of the brand's barrels of the single barrel whiskey, the military?
Right. There are the single barrel product, which, you know, yeah, folks can find in their local stores and also in local restaurants and things, Jack Daniel's single barrel, which is made from the same recipe, but the barrels are aged only on the top floors. And so that really enhances the barrel flavor. It brings up more oak and more sweet notes. And you can actually buy that product a barrel at a time. So you'll get about 250 bottles
About 10 grand, maybe?
Yeah, 10 grand or really? Maybe a little right. North of there. It's probably, depending on tax, you know, okay. State tax, local tax, it will vary.
Yeah.
But the U.S. military is our number one single purchaser of whole single barrels. So, you know, we've had a longstanding history with the military, and we're certainly,
cool.
You know, we always tip our hats at our servicemen yeah. and women around the country.
Absolutely.
For sure.
Absolutely. Now, is it true at the distillery only 1 in 100 barrels makes the cut for the 94 proof single barrel whiskey? I mean, is that how...
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. It's about 1%. So, yeah, about 1 in 100. You're right on the money there.
Mm-hmm. Wow. The distillery was listed on the National Register of Historic Places back in 1972.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Jack is made from corn, rye, malted barley, distilled in copper skills. Now, Jack Daniel's is made from corn, rye, malted barley, and it's distilled in copper stills. How does the process work, like when you're making whiskey?
Sure. Well,
without any secrets, of course.
Oh yeah, no, you know, we're an open book. Well, you know, we're 80% corn, 12% malted barley, and 8% rye. You know, you can come to the distillery, you can see it all being done. I mean, you can meet the people that are making it every single day. And so we're very open with that. You know, I think that's one of the things that makes our brand, you know, authentic, and people love to come and see and experience it. But basically what you do is you take that corn, grind it up into a meal, and you cook it in our cave water.
A mash.
Right? You make a mash, mm-hmm. right. So we've cooked that corn in the cave water, and it's kind of like grits. I don't know
okay.
if you have grits. I mean,
yep.
down south, we eat grits.
You
so
do.
I don't know about Chicago.
Breakfast, absolutely. Oh, no, I hear you. I hear you.
But anyway, it's kind of like a corn pudding. So you get all that starchy goodness out of the corn, and that's what we're going to ferment later on. So then we'll take it, we'll add our rye, we'll grind the rye, add that just for a little spiciness, a little flavor. And then we'll cool it a little bit and add the malted barley. And that malted barley, you know, the same, pretty much the same malted barley that go into a beer or something like that.
Okay.
But there's enzymes in malted barley that will break down the starches from the corn, because as you try to ferment a cereal grain with our yeast, and that literally creates the alcohol, starch will not be broken down, but we need the small, simple sugars that are made from starch. And so that's what malted barley does for us. It breaks down that cornstarch. And so then when we add our yeast, the yeast will feed on the sugar. It will make the alcohol, literally make the whiskey.
What it is, yeah.
Well, yeah, what it is, exactly. That's yeah. the birth of the alcohol. So it's about 11% alcohol. It's kind of like a corn beer. And then we just run that corn beer through our copper stills, which basically extracts the alcohol out of the beer. Because, you know, we don't sell beer, we're selling whiskey.
That's right,
so
that's
at,
right. That's
at that right. point, then it goes from 11% alcohol, we concentrate it up to 70% alcohol.
Wow. And how long is the process? Like if you're making a bottle of Jack Daniel's, a square bottle, by the way, how long does that take?
Well, it would definitely have to take more than 4 years, because the minimum aging process for any of our labels is 4 years. You know, the range is typically between 4 and 7 years. You know, a lot of people ask, well, they want to know exactly how old, you know, how many days old is it? Well, we don't really care, because we're just following these barrels. Once the whiskey is distilled, it's made, it's in the barrels, we're going to go in and sample those barrels every few months and track the flavor, the aroma, the color that's all coming from the wood of the barrel. A taster will decide when that whiskey's ready. So it will be somewhere between 4 and 7 years typically.
Why the square bottle? There's some lore behind that.
Yeah, there is some lore. You know, that goes back to Jack's day, and which was very unusual. Square bottles in that day, yeah. You didn't see it all. Most of them were all round.
Yeah.
You know, the legend has it was that Jack wanted people to know that it was a square deal. He was a square shooter, right? He was honest. You're getting a square deal. You could trust that these goods were worth the price charged, right? So that's what he wanted people to think about his product.
All right, when we come back, we're going to talk about the varieties that Jack Daniel's has to offer with Jack Daniel's assistant master distiller, Chris Fletcher. Next on 720 WGN.
Guess every Superman has got his kryptonite. Jack Daniel's kicked my ass again last night.
It's Dave Flyer on 720 WGN, and we're talking to Chris Fletcher, Jack Daniel's assistant master distiller, to celebrate the distillery's 150th anniversary. All right, so you have brought some beautiful bottles in here today. Tell me a little bit actually about all the different varieties that Jack Daniel's offers.
Right. Well, we have the original kind of recipe, the old number 7 that I think most people are most familiar with. And we use that recipe, our Tennessee whiskey recipe of 80% corn, 12% malted barley, and 8% rye.
I just gave you a wow when I took a little sniff.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the aroma is a big part of what you're tasting. That's part of the experience for sure. But, you know, what we're able to do with that one recipe, depending on what type of barrel we're using, where we put that barrel in our barrel houses and things like that, we can drive different flavors because at that point, Mother Nature is pretty much in control. However, we make all of our own barrels. You know, we're the only whiskey maker in the world that's making our own barrels. And if you look, you know, you've got the sample there, your glass. All of that color is 100% natural. There's no additives in Jack Daniel's. It's all straight from the barrel. There's no sugar added. There's no flavor added. There's no coloring added. So that's all natural coming from the wood of the barrel. That's why we make our own barrel.
They all have their own distinct, you know, aroma.
They do.
Every one of them.
They do.
Yeah.
And it's about what we can do as whiskey makers and putting the whiskey into the barrel and then allowing Mother Nature to also kind of create that art of the whiskey. So that's the thing I really like about whiskey making. I'm a chemist by trade. There's only so much science, though, that we can put into this.
Sure.
You know, a lot of it is truly art, and I think it always will be.
Gentleman Jack, tell me about Gentleman Jack.
Gentleman Jack, this is the lightest whiskey that we make. So generally the barrels that we take out of the barrel houses are going to be on lower floors. So we don't want a lot of barrel character. We want more of the natural sweet notes.
You talked about the floors before. Why the lower floors? Like, explain that.
Right, because of the heat variation.
Oh, okay.
So it stays cooler down at the bottom. It gets much warmer up at the top. So cooler floors on the bottom. So what will happen is with less heat, you won't have as much interaction of whiskey absorbing into the wood.
Makes sense.
Right?
Okay.
On the top, however, when it gets really hot, that whiskey will expand because it gets hotter.
Sure.
And it will soak into the wood further.
Yeah. Yeah.
That pulls out more color, more flavor.
Nice.
So this is more of a delicate whiskey, Gentleman Jack. And then we also charcoal mellow Gentleman Jack a second time. All Jack Daniel's is charcoal mellowed, right? Tennessee whiskey is charcoal mellowed.
So smooth.
Right. That's the difference between Tennessee whiskey and bourbon. We make bourbon, then we filter it through 10 feet of maple charcoal. We make our own charcoal by hand at the distillery.
Wow.
We don't go to the supermarket.
You don't have any Kingsford? No
Kingsford? No Kingsford, no.
Okay, good.
No, it's not what we want for making whiskey. We make our own charcoal at the distillery.
Yeah.
And so when we drip slowly, it takes about 3 days to get whiskey through 10 feet of this charcoal. When it comes out the bottom, it's still clear as water, just like it was when it came off the still. This is before the barrel.
Okay.
And now it's Tennessee whiskey, though. And so what this charcoal does, it absorbs a lot of the corn flavor, the graininess, kind of the oily flavor.
Sure.
That's not what we really want in our product. And if you nose the Jack Daniel's, you get kind of a fruity nose, maybe a little banana.
Bit. Yeah.
That's being made by our yeast, right? That's a flavor that our yeast provides. And by the charcoal mellowing process of lifting some of that corn off of it, it allows that nice sweet Jack Daniel's aroma to come through.
It's lovely.
Yeah,
it's absolutely lovely.
The Gentleman Jack's very light, very soft.
You have to have a little bit. You've been talking. You're going to have a little bit of that. Then you've got these, and by the way, beautiful bottles as well. And I love the packaging and all the stuff you do, especially the Sinatra one that came out last year. You've got the Jack Daniel's Single Barrel Select. Tell me a little bit about this because I know that's very special.
Single barrel select, absolutely. As you were mentioning, it's only 1% of the barrels will end up qualifying as that. Same recipe as the Gentleman Jack we just tasted. However, you can see it's a darker color.
Yes.
That's because these barrels are only coming from the very top. right? Gotcha. Only coming from the top floor, so you can automatically see you're getting a lot more barrel extraction, right? You're getting more flavor from the wood into the whiskey, and when you taste it, it's much richer. You get more of almost a butterscotch.
Yeah, but I was just going to say butterscotch.
Butterscotch, caramel, vanilla, all those sweet brown notes that are from the wood of the barrel. It's like I said, there's no sugar, there's no sweeteners added. It's all natural. This is Mother Nature here.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. And then the rye, that's new?
It is. This is a brand new product. It's just been released probably, I'd say, within the last 30 days. This is a straight rye whiskey. So when you talk straight rye whiskey, now you go from a corn-based whiskey, which is Tennessee whiskey, to a whiskey that has to be at least 51% rye. Now, we experimented. We started making rye whiskey about 5 years ago, maybe a little more. And we did some 51%. We didn't think it was quite what we wanted. We thought about, well, maybe we should go like 95%, but we thought that would be a little too spicy. We wanted complexity. We wanted balance and complexity in our rye whiskey. So we decided on 70% rye. We felt like it gives us a nice balance of a nice familiar Jack Daniel's sweetness. And even on the nose, when you smell it, you get that essence of Jack Daniel's, that kind of sweet note on the nose.
You do, right away, yeah.
But when you taste it, when it hits the mid-palate, that's when the rye spice is going to really kick in. And then it's going to finish very clean and very quick.
Very clean.
Yeah.
Very clean. Yeah,
very,
very cool.
Different experience. That's where the rye comes in.
Beautiful. Beautiful stuff. Now, Sinatra Select, I talked about this last year when we had Sinatra's manager and one of his closest friends on the show. And we talked about, you know, how much Frank loved Jack Daniels. I mean, that he was buried with a bottle of Jack Daniels.
Yeah.
But tell us a little bit about this, because I know it's 90 proof, and it's really one of a kind, and it's a limited edition.
It is. We started that just a couple of years ago as a way to tribute the relationship between Frank and Jack. And, you know, Mr. Sinatra was introduced to the brand in the late 40s, we think early 50s. Legend has it by Jackie Gleason. And he just fell in love with the product.
Interesting.
And if you think about it, back in the early 50s, Jack Daniels was pretty much just a regional brand. We were very small. It wasn't like you could just walk into any bar in Chicago and order a Jack. You probably couldn't find it. Our product was actually on an allocation from 1938 after Prohibition until almost 1980.
Wow.
So,
I wouldn't have imagined
that. We were very small back then. Yeah. And so, you know, Mr. Sinatra falls in love with it, calls it the nectar of the gods. The next year, our sales are, you know, up 200%. You know, it's not so easy to just make a lot more whiskey. You have to age it. You're right. Mother Nature has a big say.
You
got to
catch up almost.
You've got to catch up. Yeah. So years and years and years of trying to catch up. But the thing about the relationship with Frank and Jack is it's authentic. He was never a paid spokesperson. He truly loved our brand. Now, we did have our first ever Jack Daniel's salesman, Mr. Angelo Lucchese, who was from Memphis, Tennessee.
All right.
First ever Jack salesman, also an Italian-American. He and Mr. Sinatra were very good buddies. And so Angelo made sure Frank always had some Jack Daniels on his plane everywhere he was going. So
that's awesome. And we'll do a little toast to Frank Sinatra Jr., who just passed away recently.
Yeah, absolutely. Very sad to hear
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. So much going on to celebrate the 150th anniversary of the Jack Daniels Distillery. And for more, really, on all the events and on Jack Daniels himself, simply visit jackdaniels.com. Assistant Master Distiller Chris Fletcher. What a thrill and what a great story. Some great storytelling here.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate you hanging out.
Glad to be in Chicago. Love the city. So.
And again, people want to go do tours. They can get down to Lynchburg. You know, you fly into Nashville. It's about 40, 45-minute drive, and you can do your own tour there, too.
That's right. Yep. 7 days a week, we're open. Absolutely.
Very cool. Thanks again, pal.
Thank you.
All right. Much more ahead on 720 WGN.
Those fingers in my hair, that sly come hither stare, that strips my conscience bare, it's witchcraft.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. It's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. So in the 2010 book, Frank the Voice, we were told the story of Frank Sinatra's meteoric rise to fame, subsequent failures, and reinvention as a star of live performances and the big screen. The story of Old Blue Eyes continues with Sinatra, the chairman, picking up the day after Frank claimed his Academy Award in 1954 and reestablished himself as a top recording artist in music. Frank's life post-Oscar was incredibly dense in between recording albums and singles. He often shot four or five movies a year. He did a TV show, nightclub appearances, started his own record label, and juggled his considerable commercial adventures, which ranged from movie production, the restaurant business, even prize fighter management, along with his famous and sometimes notorious social activities and commitments. And the author James Kaplan has researched and written more than 100 major profiles of figures ranging from Madonna to Helen Gurley Brown, Calvin Klein to John Updike, Miles Davis to Meryl Streep, Arthur Miller to Larry David, Jerry Lewis, and has appeared in many magazines, including The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, Vanity Fair, Esquire, and so many others. And joining us tonight to talk about Old Blue Eyes himself is the author of Sinatra, The Chairman, and that is James Kaplan. Good evening to you, James.
Good evening, Dave.
What a phenomenal pair of books here. Over the last couple of weeks, I had the pleasure of reading the first Sinatra book, Frank the Voice, an absolutely amazing read. It took you a decade to do these two books.
Amazing. 5 years per book. Yep.
Wow. Yeah,
it's a big canvas.
It is.
Just simply an enormous life. What I say is that Sinatra was born in Hoboken in 1915 when horse-drawn wagons were plying the cobblestone streets, just a stone's throw from the 19th century, and he died on May 14th, 1998, the night of the Seinfeld finale. And his life was really the American century. He intersected with so many of the people, so many of the events, and he made so many of the events of the 20th American century.
Well, I'll tell you, these books, though, there wasn't really a definitive biography out there, in my mind, on Frank Sinatra until The Voice and The Chairman came out.
Well, thank you. If you read the previous biographies, many of them anyway, you would never know the guy sang a note of music. And I got started on this when I was finishing up the book I did with Jerry Lewis, and I went to the 2004 telethon, went out to dinner with a bunch of the musicians who were working on the show. We went to an Italian restaurant in Santa Monica, and everybody got very happy that night. We were all drinking, and they were all men of a certain age, and it turned out they had all worked with Sinatra. So since we were all so happy, I figured, okay, here it comes. And I rubbed my hands and readied myself for the women, the mob, and the fist fights. And their voices all sort of dropped to almost a whisper, and they spoke in awed tones about what an absolute musical genius Frank Sinatra had been. And I thought, isn't that fascinating? Because with these previous biographies, you would never know that. And I needed a new book to do, and I wanted something big, and boy, did I get it.
But what a great opportunity to have these people in one room for you to talk to and really inspire you to get this book going. I mean, that's fantastic.
It really was. It was kismet. It was a wonderful thing.
Now, you have said, and I've seen some other interviews from you before, that Sinatra was really the seven ages of man, referencing William Shakespeare. I mean, he really lived, 300 years in the time that he was on this planet.
Yeah, that's right, with 3 packs of unfiltered Camels and a fifth of Jack Daniels a day, and 82 years with all of that. It's unbelievable. The life force was so strong in him that I think it just carried him to that finish line. But the last years were very rough.
Now, you talked about his music and the fact that, nobody really did talk about his music. You recognize in this second book, Sinatra the Chairman, that Frank was really at his best in the 1950s when he was recording with Nelson Riddle. That was kind of a highlight for him.
I think you could argue that between 1954, when Sinatra began recording with Riddle and began with Capitol Records, he actually began in 53. From 53 to 64 or so, he produced with Riddle and with other arrangers, including Billy May, Gordon Jenkins, and others. He produced a series of an incomparable series of popular music albums, created a monument that has never been approached.
He was so hot in the 1950s. It was the Oscar. Then he had the big hit with Young at Heart.
Yeah.
He had radio show, which I just, believe it or not, listened to an episode of this on. We have a show called WGN Radio Theater. We listened to an episode of Rocky Fortune.
Rocky Fortune.
I got to tell you, that was as cucumber Sinatra, all Sinatra series,
Yes, it was kind of meta ahead of its time, wasn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely was. And he had the Frank Sinatra show on television, and then he was surrounded, as he was for most of his life until he met Barbara, but he was surrounded by just amazing women, in his life.
He was surrounded by women, and the most beautiful women in Hollywood, beginning not beginning with Ava Gardner, it actually began with Lana Turner, but Ava was the one he could never conquer, and therefore the one who fascinated him until the end of his days.
Of course. Of course, when there's a challenge,
yes,
you want it more. Of course. Yes. Of course. And then here comes the 60s. Now, his career hit some rough patches. You talk about in the book where Frank was labeled a living legend, which, you know, can be considered a flattering statement, but one, you know, might not have been the best for him. It was almost like, well, maybe his career is done.
Once the Beatles hit the popular music business like an atom bomb and really blew apart the business as Sinatra had known it. He detested rock and roll, all it represented, all it had done to his business, and he hated getting old. He hated the time the Beatles hit, he was approaching 50. He hated that number. He hated the numbers beyond it. He tried to stay young. He married Mia Farrow, who was 30 years younger than he was.
Not a real great relationship.
Well, it was. I'll tell you, it was an interesting relationship. There was one part of it that was ignored by Sinatra, and that was she was an extraordinary young woman in many ways. She was highly intelligent, sensitive, and very warm, and also surprisingly sexy. She said she always liked to say that her measurements were 20-20-20, but Frank found out otherwise. But the one thing that was important to her that Sinatra could not abide was her ambition. She was an enormously ambitious young actress.
She wanted to work.
And Frank did not want a wife of his to work. And why they couldn't have figured this out beforehand is a puzzle.
What do you think about Ava Gardner? I mean, obviously working. I mean, is that obviously maybe that turned him off to a point where he didn't like that or didn't like to compete?
The striking thing about their marriage was that they married at a point when her movie career was taking off like a skyrocket and his was heading right down the tubes. And that was extremely difficult between the two of them. She began to get sick of him. She got sick of his moping around. She got sick of his being a failure. But she performed that one miraculous act of resuscitation by going to Harry Cohn at Columbia Pictures and telling the biggest lecher in Hollywood that she would give him, Harry Cohn, a free picture if he would give Sinatra a screen test for From Here to Eternity.
That's a great
and
story.
Harry Cohn looked her up and down and thought, what else am I going to get for free out of this? And he gave Sinatra the screen test, and Sinatra nailed it.
He did. He absolutely did. You talk a lot about the many stories of Sinatra and the mob. It's always one of the most things that are talked about. We were talking actually before we got the interview started about Tony Opodisano and Don Rickles, and you know, that was probably Don's biggest punchlines with Frank right to his face.
Yeah.
About Marco Macananzo, you know, getting hurt and turning on the car and Frank's albums were playing and now that person's a highway. You know, I mean, it was the busting that had happened over the mob. It'd probably been one of the biggest stories at that time. But you talk a lot about the lives of Frank Sinatra and Sam Giancana. They intertwine quite a bit.
They intertwined quite a bit. Sinatra grew up Italian-American in Hoboken, New Jersey in the 1920s and 1930s. And this was a time when Italian-Americans were extremely low on the social scale in America. They were seen as just a half step above African-Americans. And like African-Americans, Italian-Americans were supposed to be happy, singing, dancing people. And in the case of Italian-Americans, happy, singing, dancing people who ate a lot of spaghetti and now and then shot people. So it was a vile sort of race prejudice. Sinatra suffered from it, and he began to see the mafia guys he ran into early in his life and early in his career as Italian American men of power and Sinatra thought of honor. Well, I think time disabused him of the latter idea, but he always idolized them, just like a little kid idolizes cowboys or football players, Sinatra idolized these mafia guys for the rest of his life. And John Connor was a big part of Sinatra's life, and John Connor was a very, very bad character, but had a huge influence on both Sinatra himself and on the course of Sinatra's life. John Connor was really instrumental, not directly, but a catalyst in separating Frank Sinatra from John F. Kennedy.
Absolutely, and a complete change of political parties, which we'll get to. But he asked Sinatra at some point to intercede with the Kennedys, because he was friends, obviously, with the Kennedys, to get the FBI off his back. I mean, there's some pretty in-depth stories in here. Yeah.
Yes, he asked that, and Sinatra agreed to do it and then went out and never did it.
Yeah.
And John Connor got so furious that that he seriously considered having Sinatra whacked. But one night he was, shall we say, enjoying a pleasant time with his lady friend Phyllis McGuire. And as he recounted it himself, Sam John Connor was enjoying a pleasant time with Phyllis McGuire and listening to Sinatra, as so many people did while they enjoyed a pleasant time. And John Connor thought, how could I ever kill this guy? How could I ever steal that gorgeous voice?
You know, you say that there was a interview I know you've seen with Johnny Carson and Frank, and he said, you know, when you're trying to make out Frank, what records do you put on?
Yep.
Which was really tough.
And remember what Sinatra said?
Yeah, he said.
You remember what he said?
Well, he said that he listened to some classy jazz. I mean, he joked around about some of his other contemporaries, but I mean,
what he said besides jazz was. And this was about 1976, and Sinatra sitting there with the gigantic disco collards on, and D's, Dem, and Do's talking like that. Excuse me. And he turned to Johnny Carson. He said, "I'm a Daphnis and Chloe guy.
Yeah.
I'm a sunken
cathedral.
I'm a sunken cathedral guy.
Yeah.
He was talking about Ravel and ABC.
Yeah, pretty wild." Well, stick around. We're talking to author James Kaplan in his first book, Frank the Voice, and now Sinatra the Chairman. And there's more with him next on 720 WGN.
This is my kind of town. Chicago is my kind of town. Chicago is my kind.
It's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN, and we're talking to author James Kaplan and his new book, Sinatra, the Chairman. So there was an extreme turn at some point in Sinatra's life from a political standpoint, being so liberal and supporting Kennedy to being a staunch conservative, and you really detail out the story.
It began in spring of 1962 when President Kennedy was planning a trip to Sinatra's Palm Springs house for some R&R, also known as Sun and Fun, also known as Jackie Was Traveling in India.
Uh-huh.
And President Kennedy was very excited about this trip. Unfortunately, just prior to that trip, J. Edgar Hoover, director of the FBI, had called the Attorney General of the United States, President Kennedy's brother, Robert Kennedy, and informed him that the president's lady friend, one Judith Campbell, who had been actually, again, while Jackie was away, paying visits to the president in the White House, had also recently taken up with Sam John Connor. And furthermore, that Frank Sinatra had introduced Judith Campbell to Sam John Connor and introduced Judith Campbell to President Kennedy. And therefore, the attorney general advised his brother that he could not stay at Frank Sinatra's house in Palm Springs. And instead, the president stayed at Bing Crosby's house in Palm Springs. It came out. It was a gigantic public humiliation for Sinatra. He was furious. The poor guy who broke the news to him, he was always long-suffering around Sinatra, was the president's brother-in-law, Peter Lawford, the Rat Pack ancillary.
Yeah.
And Sinatra never forgave Lawford. And he never forgave Bobby Kennedy. Curiously, he did forgive Jack Kennedy. He never really took it out on Kennedy, even sent him a rocking chair a couple of months after that. But, of course, the president was assassinated. When Hubert Humphrey ran for president in 1968, Sinatra got that old thrill again about the excitement of political power and being close to all of that, and began campaigning for Humphrey and cozying up to him. Of course, Hubert Humphrey didn't quite have the charisma of Jack Kennedy, but power itself was seductive. But then Humphrey's guys told the candidate that he really ought to get rid of Sinatra, that it would not help the campaign, for the same reasons that Bobby Kennedy told his brother that he ought to stay away from Sinatra. The Sinatra just had too many unpleasant friends, and so Humphrey dropped Sinatra. And what iced it all was, I don't want to get too much into the weeds. There was a guy named Jesse Unruh who was running for governor of California in 1970 against Ronald Reagan. And Unruh had been close to Bobby Kennedy, and despite the fact that Bobby Kennedy had been assassinated, Sinatra convicted Unruh by association. There was also a huge amount of political turmoil in the United States in 67 and 68. It began to scare Sinatra, and it began to scare him. It pushed him, as it pushed so many other men of a certain age, it pushed him rightward politically. And Ronald Reagan, whom Sinatra had once derided as kind of a bozo, suddenly became palatable to Sinatra. Sinatra's Democratic friends were horrified that he was supporting Ronald Reagan for president. But once that cat was out of the bag, and Spiro Agnew was shortly to follow.
Well, I'll tell you, that just reinstates the fact that Sinatra, he wanted to be around power. I mean, whether it was the mafia or one of the presidents of the United States or running for president, he absolutely enjoyed those associations.
Power was extraordinarily important to him, and he was able to acquire a lot of it himself, but the associations mattered to him too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, in the early 70s, he was on a farewell tour, but it was short-lived. I mean, you know, did he think it was over in the early 70s?
I think he was tired. I think that he had made a number of albums that hadn't sold, and that in itself made him feel very tired. I think he was beginning to feel sad, depressed, and somewhat irrelevant, and maybe angry about that. Maybe it was a little bit of a temper tantrum hanging it up. I'll show them what they're going to do without me. But after about a year and a half, he began to realize the world needed Sinatra. He couldn't stand that withdrawal from the adulation, and really had to come back. And the whole idea of Old Blue Eyes is back. Nobody had ever called Sinatra Old Blue Eyes. He kind of made it up himself.
That's funny.
But
that's
it stuck.
Yeah, it did. Absolutely. Absolutely did. Well, and through the 80s and 90s, his concert schedule became heavier and heavier. He wanted to be out there filling up the schedule because, you know, as you said, he felt a competitive nature because of, you know, other genres of music that took the spotlight. But in 93, Duets was released, his most successful album. It was a big deal to him to be at the top of the charts again like that.
It was a huge deal to him all his life. Selling records was extraordinarily important to Frank Sinatra. However, in doing Duets, he did something he had really never done before. He overdubbed. In the past, he had very seldom, if ever, sung over tracks, over recorded instrumental tracks. He was a man who revered musicians, and when he recorded, he always wanted to be among the musicians. He wanted to be with them in the studio, looking into their eyes as he sang those gorgeous songs. With Duets, he was not only singing over musical tracks, but he was singing these duets along with disembodied voices, people who had been recorded elsewhere. And the result was very was seductive to a certain extent. It was so seductive it went double platinum, and that was hugely gratifying to him. I don't know that deep down inside some part of him didn't feel artistically remiss for having done that.
That might have not have been his best work.
I'm sure that he knew that his best work was long behind him.
Yeah. Yeah. I mentioned to you that Tony Opitasano's joining me next. Frank's close friend is his co-manager for like 26 years. And you quote him talking about Frank and his final performances. And, you know, we're talking about February 1995. At that point, of his life. He had lost a lot of friends. He wasn't in the best of health. And he sang as capable as he could, but that was really the beginning of the end.
Yes, after February, after that last concert, those final six songs at the Marriott in Palm Springs in February of 1995, he really went home. He had been in failing health and failing mentally for a number of years. He was forgetting lyrics on stage, despite the presence of these gigantic teleprompters with the lyrics in gigantic print. He was still forgetting lyrics. He had a couple of bad incidents where he collapsed on stage, actually.
Yeah, I remember those, man.
And it was getting very rough. But once he stopped, once he went off the road, as bad as a lot of the final concerts had been, he really declined steeply after that. He always needed the adulation. He always needed the audience to buoy him up, to tell him that he really was Frank Sinatra. And the last couple of years at home were not pretty ones.
You write about the end of his life and the conflicting stories that there were out there between Frank's children and Barbara Sinatra. Everyone was pretty much trying to position themselves as being the one that was taking care of Frank and who was there with him really up till the end.
Yeah, there was a lot of ugliness at the
kinda
end.
Sad, yeah.
It was sad, and there was a great deal of argumentation between Barbara Sinatra and the children about who could be with him. And I think that the children felt that Barbara was actually keeping them away from Frank.
Yeah. And is really, you know, his music really lives on forever. And folks, we just touched the surface of this amazing book. And the first book, which was Frank the Voice, the new book, which is Sinatra the Chairman. It is honestly an amazing read. And honestly, get the pair to really understand the whole story. Great Christmas gifts as well. And you can get them at Amazon or wherever books are sold. James, what amazing storytelling in these books, and so timely,
thank you so much, Dave.
And so timely as well as we celebrate Sinatra's 100.
Well, it is a great pleasure talking about Frank, and a great pleasure talking with you, Dave.
Well, thank you, James. I appreciate that, and happy holidays to you as well.
Same to you.
Dave Player on this early Sunday morning on 720 WGN. That song means only one thing. Steve Darnall is joining us. He discovered the golden age of radio at the age of 12 while listening to Chuck Shaden's Those Were the Days, which is now his. It's a look back at the happy days, the golden years of old-time radio and beyond. Steve started his professional writing career over 30 years ago, and in 1993 contributed his first article in Nostalgia Digest, and in 2004 Steve took over as publisher and editor of Nostalgia Digest magazine. This year, now celebrating over 40 years. Steve talks about the golden age of radio at NostalgiaDigest.com, YesterdayUSA.com, TalkZone.com, and joining me tonight to talk about the autumn edition of Nostalgia Digest magazine is Steve Darnall. Good morning to you, my friend.
Good morning, David. How are you?
I am delightful. The cover, so captivating. Always curious to know who is on the front cover of this great magazine. That's just a nice... In fact, let's talk a little bit about the magazine in general. It is just a great flashback of just Americana.
Well, we're very fortunate. I mean, Chuck Shaden started the magazine 41 years ago now. Yeah. And he was always intent on it being a fairly broad umbrella in that it wasn't just going to be a magazine strictly about radio or about old movies or whatever. And that's allowed us to do an awful lot of cover an awful lot of ground. And thankfully, we have some very interesting and responsive writers who have broad interests. And so, yes, for every article you get about a radio star or a movie star, there's going to be some personal recollection.
Absolutely.
To be something about perhaps a less obscure performer or something about, you know, books or mores. It's always interesting, and we've always tried to make every article different from the one before it and every issue different from the one before it.
It's funny you say that. I was mentioning to you before we get on the air here that my uncle got the edition, the new edition, and he mentioned
you know, the cover and Frank Sinatra and said, well, you know what? I remember Rocky Fortune, which is a radio show, which we'll talk about.
Yes.
And but my, you know, my recollection of Sinatra is seeing him really in the 70s and the Rat Pack movies in the 60s. And then on Carson with Rickles and filling in for Johnny occasionally.
Oh my God,
you know,
yes.
He used to fill in quite a bit. So we all have different connections to some of these folks that you profile.
It's true. I mean, talking about Sinatra, my first exposure to him was about the age of 3 or 4 when my parents had a copy of That's Life.
Mm, okay.
It's an incredible record.
Yeah, yeah.
And as I got older, I suppose this is the case for a lot of people, as when you become a teenager or a young adult, you start to discover emotional complexity that you did not know as a child, and Sinatra's records from the late 50s were a perfect soundtrack to that. I think you know, records like Only the Lonely or In the Wee Small Hours, that, you know, at a time when you're at an age when you are convinced that you're the only person on earth who knows what heartbreak is, that is, those records are a perfect companion. And then, of course, you know, the flip side of things like Songs for Swinging Lovers, which are just the most exultant records some have ever made.
Johnny Carson once asked him, when you're trying to make out with a girl, who do you listen to? and he talked about a lot of, like, obscure jazz stuff that mm-hmm. he, you know, and you know, which was pretty interesting. But we're celebrating 100 years of Frankie. He would have been 100 this year.
Yes.
And I was looking, he made a radio debut in 1935. So, you know, it's amazing to think, you know, on WAAT, which I'm not quite sure what station that was. But
that's out of New Jersey.
New Jersey, okay.
In fact, that's the radio career of Frank is the subject of this cover story.
Right, exactly. And 7 decades, though, he's been actively part of our lives. So since the mid-30s, I mean, it's a big deal.
It's always interesting with somebody like a Sinatra, just as with a Humphrey Bogart. You know, there were no shortage of amazingly talented people, and it's always fascinating to see what little streak runs through a performer that allows them to endure.
I was looking at all the radio he did over the years. So the Jack Benny program, Abbott and Costello, Suspense. You know, everybody did Suspense. Yeah. Anybody who was anybody did Suspense.
And he is tremendous on that Suspense show. And we're going to be playing that on our radio show at Halloween.
Awesome. Awesome.
But yes, and of course, he starred on his own show. He had, you know, songs by Sinatra and things of that sort. And even when his career was going through a rough patch, he was always doing radio.
Yeah.
You know, he had a show he did with Dorothy Kirsten, the singer from the Metropolitan Opera. He did record shows when those were early becoming in vogue.
Mm-hmm.
And he even did crime drama. You know, he was the star of his own hard-boiled show, which is really charming and kind of funny when you think about it.
Yeah, for him, yeah, absolutely. But he did Bob Hope. He did the Lux Radio Theater, Bing Crosby, Kraft Music Hall, Charlie McCarthy, Burns and Allen.
Oh, yeah, well, of course, that's what performers did back then. Radio was so easy.
Yeah,
you know, compared to
accessible.
Well, right. I mean, well, you know. I mean, you show up half dressed and do this show.
Well,
every
not
week.
Anymore.
We're no, on, I know you got the cameras now.
By the way, cameras. There's the Nostalgia Digest if you're watching on WGNRadio.com. Absolutely. but Rocky Fortune, you know, played Rocky Fortunato. Fortune, a young man of several talents, constantly in need of employment, and who accepts odd jobs from the fictitious
Footloose and Fancy Free
Gridley Employment Agency. He was on from 53 to 54, only 25 episodes, mm-hmm. and I think we've got a little clip we're going to play of Rocky Fortune.
NBC presents Frank Sinatra, starring as that footloose and fancy-free young gentleman, Rocky Fortune.
I guess I've had some strange jobs in my time. Once I was a shill for a guess your weight guy in a carnival. I'd come up there looking like a rube, and he'd guess my weight at 200 even. Everybody in the crowd gives him the old ha-ha. However, they don't know I got the lead in my pants. About 50 pounds in my two hip pockets. You never really know when you start in just how a job's going to turn out. Sometimes the ones that look like the tamest turn out to be the loaded. Like the time I'm sent by the agency to play parlor maid to a gang of plaster of Paris statues. The sign on the front of the window said Oliver Bates, Objet d'Art. It looks like I've intruded on ladies' night in an uninhibited Turkish bath. Most of the plaster statues are dames, and most of the dames would be arrested on the spot if they ever set foot on Jones Beach at daylight. Pretty soon, an oily little guy slides out under the door from the back room and oozes up to me.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, what can I do for you? A reproduction for your library? A nymph? A satyr? Some fawn?
Sure, anytime. What do you got in mind?
I beg your pardon?
Oh, it's all right.
It's very cool. Very cool. I mean, just kind of mysterious. I love the music, by the way. Perfect for, you know, driving down the Lakeshore Drive or the Kennedy tonight.
Yeah, 4:30 in the morning. Yeah, it's got that sort of late night boozy feel. Well, it's interesting. This was really kind of a low point professionally for Frank Sinatra. Not the show itself.
But he had a lot of those ups and downs in his career.
He did. Well, yeah. And the early 50s were really brutal to Frank Sinatra, as I understand it. But he did this show to sort of keep his face
name out there,
his
yeah.
name out there, and of course, while he's doing this, he's shooting From Here to Eternity. So when 1954 rolls around, he has no compunctions about leaving this show behind.
Yeah, no, I bet. Well, for him, and of course, you know, won an Oscar.
Oh yeah,
From Here to Eternity.
Just
well.
Talk of the comeback of all comebacks.
But, you know, movies, music, everything. Frank was into everything. And we talked a little earlier about how there's different connections we all have to Frank. And mm-hmm. the article, fabulous article, all really based around his radio career. My recollection of Frank is the days of Johnny Carson. And I've got a great little clip of Johnny and Don Rickles and Frank hanging out. And Frank is telling a story on how Don Rickles embarrassed him at a restaurant. Let's take a listen.
Can I tell a story about what this man did to me once? You may have known or heard about this. It was a true story. This is a long time ago, long before Don got married. I was eating dinner in a restaurant in New York, and I was with some friends, and he came over to the table, and he said, Frank, do me a favor, will you? He said, I'm sitting with a very pretty girl, and I'm trying to make out, you know. And he said, I told her I know you, and she really doesn't believe me. Would you stop by the table? I said, all right. I was just about finished. I was down to the espresso. And finally, he went back, and I walked by the table, and I said, how are you, Don? Nice to see you. He said, can't you see I'm eating, Frank? What are you doing?
Classic. Classic. Legendary. Legendary. All right, more with Steve Darnall and Nostalgia Digest magazine, which you can subscribe to as well at nostalgiadigest.com. We'll have more details about that after the break next on 720 WGN.
Small hours of the morning, while the whole wide world is fast asleep.
The world is fast asleep, I think. It's Dave Blyer on 720 WGN. We're talking to Steve Darnall of Nostalgia Digest magazine. The new autumn edition of Facing the Camera, if you're watching on WGNRadio.com.
Camera one.
Camera one, with Frank Sinatra on the cover here. You got a great article here, and I was mentioning to you during the break that...
I hope more than one.
Yeah, oh no, great articles in here. But this one just talks to me about Abbott. I'm burping because you brought cookies in here. And now I can't
you
catch my
sugar son. Rush at 4 a.m.
You didn't share any with us up here?
I'm sorry.
Come on.
There's a brownie left.
There's a brownie?
Yeah, because I just blew through a couple of them already. It's so funny. So funny. But Abbott Costello, we were talking about,
yes.
You know, I'm trying to do this interview in October that we're trying to plan. We do this stuff a little bit in advance with mm-hmm. with Vicki Abbott and Chris Costello, the daughters of Abbott Costello, because it's the 80th anniversary of their first performance.
That's
on
right.
stage. And you've got a great article on here about my favorite movie of theirs, and we'll dip a little bit into it. It's Abbott Costello Meet Frankenstein.
That's right. I think we've actually seen that together, you and I.
You know what we have? Who was all there? It was in my, because I've got a little movie room.
You and
in
me
my house.
And Rich Coase.
Rich
Coase,
Sven Gulli, Dean Richards.
Dean Richards, and I want to say maybe Jim Roach.
Jim Roach from
WCIU. Yeah,
Jim Engel.
Jim Engel,
I think was there. Was Jim Engel there too? I don't remember,
I don't
but it was a whole group of geeky guys. As my wife was kind enough to make some snacks, and we watched Abbott Costello Meet Frankenstein.
Oh, yes.
That's right.
Yes, and you were kind enough to invite me back, even though I ate most of the snacks.
It was all good, all good. But this movie, it was originally to be called, by the way, The Brain of Frankenstein. It doesn't sound really funny.
No.
Because you're mixing these two things together, and no one really has ever merged comedy and horror that way.
No, I mean, there certainly had been movies like The Ghost Breakers, the Bob Hope film, and things of that sort. But yeah, this was, I think, this was certainly the first one, I think, to bring comedy, to mix comedy with the truly iconic Universal horror characters. And of course, that became standard fare for Abbott and Costello over the next decade.
Lon Chaney Jr., Bela Lugosi, which people think he played Dracula for years. He played it in Dracula. And he played it in this movie, and that was it.
That was it, and he played it on stage.
On stage, on Broadway,
You're right. It was
and Glenn
not,
Strange, too, yeah.
And Mark Matsky, this very talented writer from Ohio, had written this terrific story.
Great story.
And we're very lucky, we've talked about this before, that there are times when an article falls in your lap and you say, I know when this has to run. And when you get something like Evan Costello meets Frankenstein, you've got to run it to coincide with Halloween.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it makes the job a lot easier.
It does. I remember them talking about in the book too that Boris Karloff, they wanted him to play Frankenstein.
Oh, the Frankenstein monster, sure.
And he said, no, but I'll help you promote the film.
Mm-hmm.
It was the strangest thing. Like, why? So he'd go to all the openings and travel around the country and promote this thing, right?
Because he didn't want to make the character a burlesque, but he was okay with someone else portraying it. So
now there was comedians always on set, even though this is a horror movie. Abbott Costello always had comedians rolling around the set to make people laugh in a lot of this stuff. And there are some outtakes you can see on YouTube of like Glenn Strange, like Abbott, or Costello sitting on his lap and making the Frankenstein monster laugh in the middle. That's some pretty funny
stuff.
Somebody
had told me that I guess. Glenn Strange couldn't even look Lou in the eye after a point.
Right.
Which is funny because I was talking to somebody about this recently on our show that it's hard to watch Abbott and Costello films on television. Not because the guys aren't talented, but because they leave pauses for laughter that you really can only appreciate when you're watching it in a group.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
If you're watching it by yourself at home, you're thinking, oh, is this take done
there
yet?
There are awkward pauses in there. I never really realized why, I guess, but that's why. I'm sure they did that on radio, on television. They knew the laughter would come, so they knew the laughter would come in the theater as well.
Right, and of course, yes, if you're watching it in a group of 400 people, as you would have done 65 years ago, it's a different thing. But we were very, very fortunate to get that. And of course, it also allows us to feature Abbott and Costello on our radio show.
Yeah, awesome.
And we're going to be featuring one with them and Bela Lugosi on Halloween.
That's cool.
So you can talk to the daughters about that
as well. I got to tell you, I've said this before, old time radio. We usually visit my cousins downstate in Monticello, and there's a lot of land down there, a lot of wooded areas, even in their own backyard. They've got a little lake, and the 20 of us, and that we age from the range of, and we've got a lot of this from your Nostalgia Digest shop, some of the suspense episodes.
Oh, sure.
We sit by the lake with a bonfire, and 20 of us ages maybe 6 to 80. And we will play a couple suspenses, crack open a beer, get some s'mores on the fire. And I mean, you're literally looking around you and you hear the wind blowing the trees and everyone's got blankets and you're listening to these episodes. It's classic fare for around Halloween.
Well, and a lot of the time there's really nothing else like radio drama and radio comedy because it used sound in a way that no one else has.
True. A lot of other great articles in here. Talk about the notorious flight of Wrong Way Corrigan.
Yes. Well, Wrong Way Corrigan, for those who don't know, was a young pilot who emulated Charles Lindbergh and really wanted to do a round-the-world flight, a transatlantic flight, and could not quite get everything put together. Mm-hmm. He was trying to get certification to fly, and of course, around the time he was doing this, Amelia Earhart disappeared, so the FAA was very leery about granting these licenses. And so what he did was he started to fly west and from New York, and then accidentally, he'll say, turned the plane around and flew to Ireland.
Wow.
And of course became a major celebrity in the sense not only that, everyone was wondering, you were flying to Los Angeles and how did you end up in Ireland exactly? But also, I think people sort of appreciated the fact that, you know, he, you know, you couldn't get what you wanted, but you took a chance on getting it anyway. And he became something of a celebrity, appeared in a couple of movies as himself, and at least one movie as himself. And this was an article by a fellow who's written for us before, and it just kind of fell into our lap. And it was really one of those, when you're putting an issue of the Digest together, you're sort of putting things into slots, and you realize you may have a quota of this sort of article or that, mm-hmm. and you're looking for that one thing that will just tie everything up in a bow, and this was one of those articles. So I was really fortunate.
The Golden Age of Galaxy Science Fiction magazine. That was a big deal way back when.
Yes. I mean, at the time before CGI, you know, and really...
Yes.
I mean, you know, at the dawn of the atomic age, the possibility that space and the future held great things for us, that was a sentiment that was widely shared. And science fiction writing was at the forefront of that. And we had seen this article by Larry Johnson about Galaxy Science Fiction magazine in another.
Do you have any of them? Have you seen them yourself?
I don't have any copies myself. Yeah, right. People do send me magazines occasionally, but not that one.
Okay.
I certainly know some of the stories because they were anthologized on radio in some cases. But we had seen that in another publication, and I thought, you know, that actually would work perfectly with what we're doing.
Memories of a Hollywood Stunt Writer, Hollywood Goes to War.
Sure. Well, both terrific articles. Walter Scannell, who wrote the latter, I mean, he put this marvelous sort of piece together about a number of the movie actors who sought to serve in the military during the war. The Hollywood Stunt Writer piece, I absolutely adore. This woman, bless her heart, she lives in Canada now, but she is in the, I think she's in the Hollywood Stunt Writing Hall of Fame or whatever that may be. And forgive me, I'm getting that wrong. But she sent us this article about working as Ann Baxter's double in the film Yellow Sky. And she was very, very sweet about it. She actually sent this piece along, and I read it, and I said to her, you know, it's great, although it seems to be a whole lot of different articles in one article, which writers sometimes do.
Sure.
And what if you wrote about this thing in particular? And she did write about working on Yellow Sky and working with Gregory Peck and Ann Baxter, whom she did not particularly care for, but... That's what you
reflected
learn.
Reflected in this article, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But, you know, it was just such an amazing experience and one that was clearly unique to her and one that we knew would, as a result, be unique to our readers. And that's all you can ask for, my goodness.
A Few Moments with Margaret O'Brien.
Oh, well, a few years ago, we began this regular feature called A Few Moments With because, mm-hmm. Just like you do, we've interviewed people for our show who had some connection to the Golden Age of Entertainment. In October, we're going to be featuring the conversation we had with Margaret O'Brien.
That's great.
We spoke with her on the phone last fall, and she was just a delight. We had about half an hour with her, and she told this... Well, in the Digest, she talks a little bit about a credit that not many people know she has. She was the Gerber baby.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
So before she was Tootie Meet Me in St. Louis.
1930s, 20s?
Yeah, she was late 30s. She was about 2 or 3 years old. And she did talk about doing that and being discovered by a photographer and subsequently being discovered by MGM. And in the conversation we have, she also talks about her radio career, and we're going to be talking about that on our show. But she did also talk about doing Jane Eyre with Orson Welles, which was just a great experience. And she was just a delight to speak to.
But just hearing from, in an article form and in your audio interview, of some of these greats from just a different era gone by and still having these people with you and have the opportunity to talk to them is amazing enough.
We're very fortunate in that regard. There are a number of folks who are still out there who still remember it. We've gotten to talk to many of them over the years. And yes, that's what these things are about. It's about capturing stories that might otherwise be lost.
How do folks get Nostalgia Digest, Steve?
Well, of course, we're in several hundred stores nationwide, including a lot of Barnes & Nobles. The easiest, most direct way would be to go to NostalgiaDigest.com, or you can call our offices at 773-769-6575.
And we'll put that information in the podcast at WGNRadio.com.
Marvelous.
Steve, thank you so much, my friend.
Thank you, David.
Have
always
a lovely
a pleasure.
Sunday. Get a nap in, will you?
And you too.
All right.